Hey, look at this. That climb is exponential.
The figures are minute, down in the thousands.
Let's take a look anyway. They may have something worth chasing.
Now, I understand why people prefer watching television to the radio. They've worked out how boring it is watching the radio. This is Max Headroom on Big Time. I had to spend a little time recently with a parrot. It's true. I won't tell you why, but what amazes me is why anybody would want to spend any time at all sitting at home teaching a bird to talk. I mean, what's wrong with the rest of the family, huh? And of course, they teach it something really interesting, like, who's a pretty boy?
What I want Get to know is me if caviar rice. Is a rich man's food...
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 8 minutes past five. World War III, week 18. Well, we shall see. It's a bit of a pause, and we'll be talking about that a little bit later. And welcome to the Bristol Politics Show on the 3rd of July, 2026, streaming live from the Cumber Centre, close by Bristol City Centre. Don't believe a word we say here, but we do try to share a few moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port turned merchant venturer fiefdom in the City of London's Empire of Lies. That is to say, finance, capitalism, the City of London, livery companies and royalty seem to rule the day. As we have no election for our new Prime Minister, that everyone has just decided he's going to be the guy. Bristol's only national news show is coming to you live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, at holylandradio.com in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Bristol Politics Show app, available free from GitHub and Apple App Store at thisweek.org.uk. You'll get the link, but it's not available from the evil Google Play. Funny that, isn't it? This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the Talk Radio stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. Tonight, no Martin Summers, who's having a week off, but we've got Donald Mack and Paul McDonald. Donald is a comedian, generally Labour-leaning. Paul McDonald is the chair of the Wales and Mendip Reform UK. And we'll also be hearing about chemtrails from astrophysicist and the former president of the Student Union of Imperial College. You're not going to believe the person that I will now tell you that is. It's Piers Corbyn, Jeremy Corbyn's brother. Yes, he was. He was president of the Student Union at Imperial College London. Although apparently he doesn't really support empires anymore. Also, we'll be hearing from former Syria ambassador Peter Ford. And also on Russia and Iran. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist zero-trust agenda, bending our minds with Orwellian BBC Verify, and boring us to tears with vacuous celebrities' puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the hero. But you won't be getting any of that down here. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie, sorry for all you royalists out there, and his vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British public, as well as Iran, China, Russia, the BRICS, or anyone apparently who's not their mate. The Crown is prosecuting us for praying for unborn children, if you can believe it. So, Chaos Lord Netanyahu also is having fun over in the Middle East. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? Anyway, so to introduce our two guests, I'll start with you, Donald.
Hi.
Don, actually, I think.
Yeah,
it's,
works.
It's better, isn't it? It works.
It works.
Can you just tell us a bit more about yourself? Like, you know, Paul was asking me, who is this guy? I said, well, he's a sort of Labour-leaning, he's involved in the charitable sector. Oh, yeah, and he's a comedian.
I don't know if I define myself by being a comedian or a writer or I would say I'm a man of substance. No, I'm. I say that laughingly. I guess I am left of centre. That's definitely. But I think I'm probably more left than I probably give on or give out, because you know to me it's pretty much a plague on all their houses. Always has been. Always will be. But I'm a pragmatist. I'm very much a believer in doing what works. I'm a community worker by trade, if you like, a community development worker. That means that my philosophy for my job, in order to do the job, is to start from where the people are, not where I think they are or where I'd like them to be, but where they genuinely are, and work with them. I realise the limits of that. So I have a tendency to appreciate a benevolent dictator every now and again, but probably it'll have to be me. So then I don't trust anybody else except me.
So what is a community development worker?
Somebody who, for me, it's somebody who goes and works with basically your grassroots community. At least that's where you start, in halls, putting on events. I started working with young children doing arts events, and then we decided to put on a show. I also worked for organizations where I took young people with mental and physical disabilities and did activities with them, took them swimming. So that kind of thing, you know, literally in a church hall. Stuff. That's where I started. In fact, it was a church hall, a scout church hall, the church hall that used by the scouts. So I wasn't even a scout. And I was taking it would be against the law now what I was doing under health and safety, because I was like 11, 12, 13, taking a van filled. I wasn't driving, but directing the driver of the community transport, picking up these kids, taking them to the swimming pool, and I'm kind of looking after them. And I'm 13. And then, obviously, not in the water, there's instructors and things, and then I direct them home, and then they drop me home. Don't know the name of the guy. I don't know if he'd been health and safety checked or anything, you know what I mean? So I started there.
Doing stuff that needs doing that no one else is doing. So you're looking
around,
bringing
people together.
Why is no one doing that? And rather than complaining, as so many do, they go on social media these days and they go, why is no one doing it? You just did it.
I think that's pretty much how I've been my whole life, yeah. But it's doing it not on my own, and I'm not doing it for me. I'm doing it with others, for others. And I'm still trying to work out, am I a super sucker, or should I just be chasing the money, you know? But really, I've always been about people. Every job I've had in my life, and including a bit of DJing for a long while, and I do a radio show, I do podcasts. It's in a sense, I very much come from that school. That it's a school of, you know, if you get up the ladder, even a couple of steps, you keep the ladder down so others can come up. And I'm very much about keeping the ladder, so that, you know, or creating connections, building bridges, making pipelines so that people can get out of where they are and try and make a better thing for their life in whatever field that I'm working in, including comedy. And every now and again, I try and do it for myself as well.
Okay, so also joined by Paul McDonald. Do you want to just say something about you, Paul? Because before we switched ourselves on just a minute ago, you were talking about doing debates with, you know, over in Trinity College Dublin, because you're actually originally Irish.
Yeah, I mean, I ran think tanks in Ireland. One was called the Edmund Burke Institute, and then another one was called
Edmund Burke.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's Irish. His statue was outside Trinity College.
I thought he was a Bristol MP, wasn't he?
He was MP for Bristol, yeah. But he was Irish, and he it was who was really seen as the father of conservatism. His most famous book being Reflections on the Revolution in France.
I've read it.
Which is a takedown of the French Revolution, which was kind of him, partly him, sort of celebrity worshipping poor old Marie Antoinette. And he wrote, he described the terror. It was actually fake news, because he described the terror before it happened, and then it happened. So
this is the guillotines.
Yeah, so in essence, Burke is the person who charts the sort of British-American channel, you know, because revolutionary politics diverges at the French Revolution, and you have a kind of scorched earth year zero approach, which is the French Revolution, which goes through the Soviet Revolution, which goes through the Chinese Revolution, Chairman Mao, which goes through, I guess, Pol Pot and some of the more extreme forms. And then you have the English Revolution, the Glorious Revolution, as it were, and that's much more evolution.
Hang on. People talk about the English Revolution as the Civil War, but actually, of course, the Civil War was all undone when it came to the Glorious Revolution, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Civil War gets absorbed into, I think, Britain's sort of constitution settlement, or at least the lessons are learned. But the difference between Burke praises the American Revolution, and he condemns the French Revolution. And he condemns the French Revolution because it's too extreme, it's scorched earth. He says society doesn't work like that, society has to evolve and be more reasonable.
Isn't he the guy behind that quote, all is necessary for the triumph of evil, as good men do nothing?
It's often attributed to him, but I'm not sure that he actually said it. Right. I'm not sure that he said it.
Well, okay. Maybe no. We should fact-check that.
He should hold on to it because there's not a lot of other quotes that he's known for.
That's so true,
and
yeah.
And that's a pretty good one.
It is. It's a lovely one. It's a very important one. I think it's a kind of crucial one.
He was a brilliant writer.
And a bit of a geezer, apparently. Anyway, so, yes, lovely to have that connection between Ireland and Bristol.
Yeah, so I ran these think tanks, and then I worked. I represented insurance companies to the Irish regulator and also in Brussels for about 10 years. And then I set up a think tank. And then I worked in Brussels for an organisation called the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. And they are an American think tank who essentially represent the interests of big tech in America.
Wow.
And I worked for them for a year.
That was before they became the masters of the universe.
Well,
they
were just getting ready.
It was only about 2016. And I did that for a year. And then I came back here and set up a think tank with a man called John Higgins, who founded Tech UK, which is the trade association. My interest has always been in public policy that affects things like free speech and economic, you know, and the economy.
So what would you do about the revelation on, I think it was the BBC World Service, this lunchtime, had a piece about Meta deliberately targeting child pornography adverts at people. And the person who was doing the investigation, what she was doing was trying to find these adverts. When she found them, she'd report them to Meta, and Meta would say, no, there's no problem with this child porn. So, I mean, you know, there seems to be little or no regulation.
Yeah, is that true? I'll accept that the BBC is saying it's true.
It's probably a World Service report, and yeah, it's probably pretty robust.
Yeah, it's probably true if the World Service say it's true. At a guess, I would say it's probably just the fact that, you know, policing what's on a platform like Meta.
But apparently it's their own advert.
Yeah.
Right? So all I'm saying is I think these tech companies are extremely dodgy.
It's probably more incompetence, Tony, than anything else. It would be very surprising if directors of Meta were knowingly doing...
Meta's statement they gave to the BBC said, we have automatic AI that looks at all this stuff.
And that
may be the problem. So maybe that's Meta's problem, is they shouldn't detects things. They should have people looking at them.
Yeah, if it's a... I mean, they would be in big trouble.
But yeah, them and Twitter, X, pay some people to do it. You would realise...
It's horrific. Anyway, look, we're not here to talk about that. We will talk about it, but I'd just like to get both of your takes, you first, Don, on this whole Burnham business, because Starmer, I think it's pretty clear, has gone mainly because of the Mandelson vetting scandal, and that he stood there in Parliament and told everybody that, I'm very, very sorry that nobody told me that the vetting hadn't gone through, and there were various murmurs in the background of his own, from his own benches, saying, why didn't you ask, from Diane Abbott, for example. And so that has sort of led to this situation where he's an untenable. And yet there's been no... I mean, are you actually a Labour member?
Never have been.
Right. But what do you make of this idea of Burnham just being decided? He's the guy.
Apparently it's within the rules. So constitutionally, it's allowable.
It is within the rules for people not to stand. But I would imagine that some of them have been... respectfully requested. Is it okay if you don't stand?
No, I think actually it's more a case of, I don't think any of them could get 81 people to agree that they should stand. And in the current situation and the current climate, they'd rather have, as you call it, a coronation.
So it's not that the city and people like this have just said that he's the guy who wants to take over.
No,
we
I don't
had
think
a similar
it is.
Thing with the Tories, didn't we?
Yeah, most of these things, it's usually Sunak more cock up than conspiracy, these things, and they've kind of just fallen into that. Because even Al Keynes was about to, the man who would be prime minister if his boss didn't want to be prime minister, former boss didn't want to be prime minister ahead of him. You know, he thought, well, maybe there's a move here for me, but then he's realised there's just no point. He can't get 81 people to support him. I'm actually okay with it. I've decided that I'm okay with it because I've looked at you know, other times that it's happened, and it's not breaking any rules. Constitutionally, it's okay. You cannot say that he stood for, he hasn't been elected, or people haven't talked about him, because we did nothing but for 3 weeks talk about him and Makerfield.
He was elected in Makerfield, not to number 10, wasn't
but no other no prime minister is elected to number 10. Every prime minister is elected in their constituency, you know, the first among equals thing. And so therefore, no prime minister, we don't have presidents here. We've never had a president here. Some of them, like Blair, might try to act like a president, but none of them are. They're all first among equals. And under the rules, you know, as much as I might want to change them personally, but under the rules as they are, legally, lawfully, constitutionally, he's totally okay. And in the end, we want to change the system a bit, which I would love to have a conversation
about. Well, I think Ed Miliband did change the system to give Labour members more of a say, but now they haven't had
say. They're not going to get a
say. They're not going to get a say. Well, anyway,
that's a long problem for them, you know, because when they do get a say, they elect people like Corbyn, which then the other side of the pot. And the same in the Tories. You know, the same thing happened with the Tories, which is why all the wets left.
Well, this is one of the things I just wanted to point out, just looking at the, during the week, looking at the history here, is that when Rishi Sunak was elected leader of the Conservatives, there was a whole process within the MPs to select a few that they wanted to be in charge, and it came down to him and Penny Mordaunt. Mm. And then at the last minute, Penny Mordaunt said, "Oh, I changed my mind. I don't want to stand."
Mm.
So there was no election there either. Anyway, so before we hear from Paul, let's go back to a couple of months ago when Starmer had to come in front of the House of Commons and explain that despite being refused vetting, he had decided that Peter Mandelson was going to be the ambassador to the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. With permission, I'd like to provide the House with information that I now have about the appointment of Peter Mandelson as our ambassador to the United States. But, Mr. Speaker, before I go into the details, I want to be very clear with this House that while this statement will focus on the process surrounding Peter Mandelson vetting an appointment, at the heart of this, there is also a judgment I made that was wrong. I should not have appointed Peter Mandelson. I take responsibility for that decision. And I apologise again to the victims of the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who were clearly failed by my decision. Mr. Speaker, last Tuesday evening, the 14th of April, I found out for the first time that on the 29th of January 2025, before Peter Mandelson took up his position as ambassador, the Foreign Office officials granted him developed vetting clearance against the specific recommendation of the United Kingdom security vetting that developed vetting clearance should be denied. Not only that, the Foreign Office officials who made that decision did not pass this information to me, to the Foreign Secretary, to her predecessor, the Deputy Prime Minister, to any other minister, or even to the former Cabinet Secretary, Sir Chris Warmold. I found this staggering. And therefore, last Tuesday, I immediately instructed officials in Downing Street and the Cabinet Office to urgently establish the facts on my authority. I wanted to know who made the decision, on what basis, who knew. And, Mr. Speaker, I wanted that information for the precise and explicit purpose of updating this House. Because this is information I should have had a long time ago. And it is information that this House should have had a long time ago. It is information that I and the House have the right to know.
So, apologise for going back so long to listen to that speech, but it's like, who made the decision? It was you made the decision, and you made it very, very wrong. And just after we heard that, we also had various people, including Zara Sultana.
Yeah, Anderson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The problem the Prime Minister's got is no one believes him. The public don't believe him. The MPs on this side of the House don't believe him. His own gullible backbenchers don't believe him. So does the Prime Minister agree with me? He's been lying.
Prime Minister, please.
Sorry, we don't use those words, and I'm sure the members withdrawn it.
Mr. Speaker, I have the greatest respect for you and your office, but I will not withdraw. That man couldn't lie straight in bed.
The order. Mr. Anderson, you'll have to leave. Phil Brettle.
So that was Lee Anderson. Zara Sultana all said they said the same thing. So, I mean, there were MPs who were prepared to just simply say, look, the guy's lying. What do you make of the demise of Starmer, particularly the way that the whole thing is now seamlessly transiting to this guy, Andy Burnham?
There was a kind of inevitability about it, I think. It wasn't that surprising. He seems to be a sort of almost... just a product of the system, you know. Someone described him as an avatar for the blob, and the fact that all this went wrong, and then he talks about it as if he's a witness rather than a participant. You know, it's like that scene in Casablanca. You know, I'm shocked to hear that there is, you know, I think it's drinking in this establishment or something like that. So it doesn't surprise me. It certainly didn't shock me, and. The fact that it's seamlessly going into Burnham, again, no surprise. It's just more of the same. I said the other day about Burnham, it's a bit like, I think, at the end of the Roman Empire. You know that it's all obviously going pear-shaped when they appoint this guy emperor, and his name is Romulus Augustulus. I think he's a child, and they give him this kind of diminutive name, you know, named after the founder of Rome, Romulus, and Augustulus, of course, Augustus. And so it's that sort of, we're at the kind of Romulus Augustulus children's TV presenter kind of stage. There is something of the kind of Blue Peter Prime Ministership about Burnham. You know, you expect him to come and talk to us like that great, I think it was two comedians had this great sketch. Armstrong and Miller had this great spoof sketch of the BBC Blue Peter apologies, which were quite hilarious. So they're speaking in children's language about doing the most awful, things. But it reminds me of that. It's a kind of a children's TV program, Prime Ministership.
So what does that tell us about the politics in this country and the old duality of Labour-Conservative?
It's the end state. I mean, it's the end state of the Blair-Cameron destruction, you know, constitutional vandalism. I mean, I completely agree with both Peter Hitchens and David Starkey on this. That Labour and Conservatives during that time just gave away all the power, all of the agency even of ministers and of Parliament to the Supreme Court, to Quangos, to the devolved bodies in the nations. And so, you know, and partly why they were so outraged about Brexit is because, of course, that was simply another agency to which they had devolved so much power. And so politicians simply are sort of, you know, front men for decisions that are taken by systems and that people can't change. And so inevitably we're going to wind up with a kind of almost childlike, childish politics.
Don, do you think politics has been receding in our lifetimes?
Oh, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. When was the last time we had a politician that did anything of substance? That really moves things forward. I mean, you know, like just yesterday, Keir Starmer had to apologise for another scandal. Every prime minister has to do that. They keep apologising, and in 50 years' time, someone will be apologising for this mess.
Usually, when the last person who needs compensating has died.
Yeah, and they don't have to pay any money for it. Yeah, that seems to be the thing. But I mean, you know, we have, to be honest, since the post-war government and the building of having a plan for social housing or setting up the NHS before that, what have they done really that has made a difference? And you're right, they've seemed to, I wouldn't go as far as saying that they have given up their agency sent it out to quangos and things of that nature. I think they're just the quality of politician has gone down, and I think it's gone down tremendously. And it has been a deterioration. This is not a praise of Thatcher, but since the Thatcher era, the quality has gone decidedly down since the Thatcher era. It's not related to Thatcher. I just think it's as we have dumbed down in many things, including no disrespect to you, and I don't include you actually in this statement I'm about to say, but in terms of journalism, it's just slowly been dumbing down and down. And you'd mentioned Blue Peter,
yeah.
And I said, oh yeah, but it's more like it's all more like a game show.
It's a bit like I am slightly obsessed about you know, to what extent we are victims of kind of things just coming out of modernity.
Mm.
So. I have a strong sense that we're ruled by process. You know, all Starmer ever talked about was process. We're going to follow the process, and everything is process. You know, health and safety, literally everything is process. You can't get anything done because you can't build anything because of process. The whole country is run by processes in an environment where everything is run by process. Politicians, even if they're any good, can't do anything.
Mm.
And so,
well, one thing in that process, and you touched on this in journalism. Journalism should expose this. That's where this stuff should be out in the public.
Absolutely.
And the public can point the finger and throw the rotten tomatoes at the man, the pompous one. In fact, satire used to do this really well with things like Spitting Image, not the 9 o'clock news.
Mm-hmm.
Every week,
mm-hmm.
somebody would be lambasted, and then they'd have to stand up in front of everyone.
Yeah, but remember, what we have is a politics where the stakes are low. The actual stakes for politicians are quite low, you know, because they don't have that much authority.
Yeah, I've linked it. Someone else has called it the footballification of politics, but it's actually, I think it's deeper than that, because the footballification for me starts from the point where the commentators, i.e. the journalists, have been dumbed down, so they ask stupid questions and the politicians can then get away with it with their media trained stupid answers. So it's almost eating itself in this declining spiral of a word that I'm not allowed to use on air. So in a sense, we're getting what we deserve. But we've allowed this system to be created.
The thing is, nobody's been asked. This is something where these various elite institutions, whether it's politics or media or universities, are slowly being stuffed with yes men and yes women, people who are not going to rock the boat. Anyway, so I just think one of the places this should always happen is on BBC's Question Time. This is a place which is in front of a live audience, you know, where you get a few of these politicians, maybe a journalist. And actually, in the one that they had on the emergency one last week, or not emergency, what they call it, a special.
The major over the one?
This is over the resignation of Starmer last Monday.
Okay.
So they had on Friday, they had a BBC Question Time special. I think it was from Kettering.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I mean, I just thought it was the most boring program I'd ever...
It wasn't the Zia Yusuf one, was it?
Yeah.
It was. He took over the show, really.
Well, it seemed to me he's the only one actually saying anything that was bringing things to life.
Yes, he was, that's true.
But the rest of them were sort of almost been selected for their two-dimensional thinking. The journalists, the other politicians, they didn't want to rock the boat. Nobody wants to rock the boat. In fact, Andy, I don't think even Andy Burnham particularly wants to rock the boat. He wants everything to go through smoothly. He's been told by his PR people, look, just don't say anything. That's the best thing, just nothing.
Although, I will say this, he made his first speech and didn't take questions, which did force every journalist to think about what he said rather than what they wanted to ask
him
about.
Well, no, but this is just the way. You have to have interrogation.
No, there has to be. I'm not saying that there shouldn't. No, I'm not saying there shouldn't be interrogation. Absolutely, there must be interrogation. But as it was his first speech, he left them all going, and he even had a dig at Chris Mason from the BBC. I don't know if you caught it near the beginning. And I think, you know what? Nice one, mate. Good on you. Yes, at some point he will have to be interrogated.
Well, Trump does this, doesn't he?
That wasn't interrogation either.
Trump does this thing where he's, oh, you're fake news. I'm not answering the question for you. Mm. So maybe he's going. Anyway, let's have a little listen to that question time.
I hopefully won't go down that road.
Let's have a listen to that little question time, because Zia Yusuf did pick up this whole business of, are we just going to have a coronation? Is this actually a monarchy, the Labour Party?
We have a £350 billion welfare budget. But he also, there is room within the existing rules, and Rachel Rees has already used some of it, to have more investment And particularly on things that he's talked about, on infrastructure, on housing. There are ways that he can do that, but he will have to do it in a way that people in the markets respect and can see it's going to be well spent.
Zia.
You know, I just can't believe we're back here again. I can't believe we're back in a place. You know, the Tories gave us five prime ministers in 6 years. This is, again, a situation where we have a career politician who's not had a proper job in his entire life, foisted on the people of Britain as Prime Minister without them having any say on it. 0.03% of the British public have voted for Andy Burnham. And the first question today was from Peter, who asked, you know, does this man have a vision? I mean, I'd love to know how many of you, put your hands up if you can see a vision that Andy Burnham has for the country. Okay. So here's what we know about Andy Burnham for sure. He has already become the king of U-turn, and he hasn't even become Prime Minister yet. In the last couple of years, he's taken the following positions. He said that we should allow biological men to go into women's changing rooms, but also that we shouldn't. He said that illegal migrants should immediately get lifetime access to welfare, but also that they shouldn't. He said that we should rejoin the European Union, but also that we shouldn't. This is a man who has no principles. He is an empty vessel. And here's the really important point. Whatever your politics are, I think one of the reasons we've had this endless conga line of clownish prime ministers in this country that have been unable to govern for the British people is because you need a mandate. Now, what you've seen all of this nonsense, Shabana Mahmood and Mike Tapp tweet warring against each other. Not a single Labour minister right now is focused on what matters, which is governing for the British people. If Andy Burnham was a decent man, and maybe he is, then he would put his case to the British people, draft a manifesto, and call a general election.
Not here.
I think that, you know, the big question I have for you, especially Emily, is that, you know, if you're saying that you don't mind who the person is, but you mind if they deliver the policy for the people, absolutely fine. But why not any one of the X amount of Labour MPs? Why are they all so scared of running in a leadership election against somebody who was parachuted in last minute to essentially lead the country? Why is so everybody so scared of running against Andy Burnham? Why not actually let him say what he believes in and let
the
Labour Party
contest.
Members? Yeah, have a proper contest.
Okay. I'll come to it. Can I hear in the front?
It's all well and good. I think Mr. Starmer wasn't very popular because first past the post meant that he didn't have a very large majority of the vote. Less than a third of the country gave him a super majority. And I don't think Mr. Burnham, when he comes down, is going to be able to do things very much differently because they're all beholden to the donors that are chucking money at them. So, you know, I'm despair every time I hear the panel talk about attacking the welfare again. They leave the poor, disabled, and the sick and the ill alone.
Paul, what do you make of that? That's Zia Yusuf from your party intervening there. And also some quite good points made by the audience. This whole business of the first past the post means that you've got a ruling party with a working majority, quite a good one, on a third of the vote.
Well, it gets back to what Don was saying. I mean, first of all, yes, it's constitutional. You know, how they're electing Burnham is constitutional. And actually, I don't get that excited about it. I mean, it's the way the system works. Having said that, I think both Keir Starmer and Burnham are essentially, you know, prime ministers or will have been prime ministers who didn't really have public support for taking the country in the direction they've taken it. You know, there wasn't an appetite to sort of slap taxes on farmers. There wasn't an appetite to slap VAT on private schools, something which no other country in Europe does. And, you know, there is an appetite to get to grips with planning, to get to grips with illegal immigration. And again, you know, no real movement from Labour on this. But, you know, there have been things that they've done in government which have been, I think, quite bad, quite spiteful, and have annoyed people.
Go on, what?
Well, I mean, you have the VAT on schools. You have tax increases, which went against their promises, with the national insurance increases, which is the same thing. And so, you know...
They scrapped the two-child benefit, haven't they, Cap? That's something positive. Okay, they took a lot of money away from winter fuel payments for pensioners. So there's been a
but they show no real curiosity about dealing with things like, you know, very large number of children who are receiving benefits to take them to school. You know, because they've been diagnosed with all sorts of conditions like ADHD, and that population of the school going population has been going up and up and up, and there's no real willingness to tackle that and to get to the root of that. You know, Britain is being governed, and the Tories were guilty of this too. Britain is being governed by people who are pretending to the electorate that it's a rich country. Britain's not a rich country. I remember...
We're the seventh richest country in the world.
Used to be the sixth.
It's going down a little tiny bit, but that's still pretty rich, isn't it?
No, but the thing is... It's
GDP per head, that is.
Well, per capita, Britain is, I think, now falling behind Italy. I remember asking people in the late 1980s, I remember asking colleagues of mine, you know, do you think we are richer than Germany? And most of them said, oh, yeah, we're definitely richer than Germany. They had no idea. I mean, even then, Germany was a much bigger economy than Britain. So I think, you know, British people have been overestimating how wealthy the country is for a long time.
Well, one thing that's definitely going on is this idea of people... So, for example, with energy, with housing, people are having to spend loads of money on things that should be much cheaper. And that's good for GDP. It makes it look as if the country's doing well.
Sorry, I did ignore the elephant in the room on Labour policy, which in fact is energy. The energy policy in the country is catastrophically stupid. We're importing oil from Norway because we won't drill for it ourselves, because we want to cut our net zero targets. It's amazing how the electorate have been sold, and a lot of people believe it, they've been sold, you know, the net zero idea, as in we have to get to net zero.
Have they? I don't know if people have actually got any choice.
I think enough people have been sold.
You have to pay the bill. You have to put fuel in the tank.
If I had said to you, or you had said to me, in any government since we were born, up until about 15 years ago, that if there's a doubling of energy prices, whoever's in power is going to be thrown out of office. I mean, that would have been night follows day. That would have been considered a disaster, doubling of energy prices. And yet, energy prices have gone up by about 2.5 times in the last, since 2020.
At least we've been helping save the planet.
And they're building this sort of parallel system for renewable energy, which is all going to be colossally expensive, colossally inefficient. And by the way, Miliband's claim, and this is his core claim to the electorate, that, you know, once we get to net zero and we're relying on renewable energy for much more of our electricity, once we get there, it's going to be cheap because, you know, the wind is cheap. This is complete nonsense. It's just not true.
Well, the way the energy prices are fixed these days is a bit of a game, really. So the solar power, you're not paying solar prices for it. You're paying more like nuclear prices.
It's a bit like the
move from tobacco to vapes. It's the same companies that control it. They just change the game and change the name. I don't get down to the... you mentioned Miliband, and I remember that Zia Yusuf kept saying Thunberg, you're being led by the nose and personalising this stuff. What I do know is this, is that climate change is real, and we, all of us, from wherever we are on the planet, should do the best we can from where we are to address that.
The question is net zero the solution? Because this is what I'm coming, my own mind, I'm increasingly convinced that net zero is not going to solve things at all.
I don't think we'll ever get to net zero, because the political forces and the powers that be, the lobbyists and the big corps, they've got their things until they control it and then make it so. And then it feels, you know, when they're controlling all the resources, then yes, then they'll, you know, when everything dried up, they've sucked the last drop of oil out of the earth. The solution for me is, as quickly as possible, address the things that are causing the climate to change, that's made the temperature, the average temperature, the last 35 last week across Europe. So these kind of things, we need to find ways to address them in practical ways. Renewable sounds much better than oil and gas, which is limited.
Yeah, every 5 years or so, we have an El Nino year. So this year is an El Nino year. So temperatures are going to be higher anyway. Now, I'm not saying climate change isn't happening at all. Of course, it is happening, quite obviously, from just in my lifetime. You know, the winters are much less cold. There's less ice around. There's hardly any snow. We used to have massive snow drifts where I lived in southeast London, and you couldn't move for sometimes for weeks. So climate change is definitely happening, but I don't hear the BBC pushing this stuff about El Nino year. So they're very much on one side of the discussion. And the solution is always, Paul, is it always seems to be net zero.
We need, well, look, I think we should pay attention to people like Bjorn Lomborg, who's an economist and writing about climate policy. And Bjorn Lomborg's very good because he makes observations. He says, the difference between, I worked within the insurance industry for a long time, the difference between people who suffer very badly in a weather event, a storm or a hurricane or a heat wave, and those who get through it, who sail through it without any harm, has all to do with money and wealth. You know, if you've got, I mean, for example, if you live in Arizona where the average temperature, I don't know what it might be, let's say 40 degrees in July in certain parts of Arizona or higher, nobody dies. Why? They're rich. That's why they don't die.
They turn on the air conditioner.
They have,
they've adjusted their country to the climate of where
the thing is that the best way to cope with climate change or, you know, weather events, extreme weather events, is you need to have enough money and capital to build the right kind of houses to cope. And even if we accept that we have to reduce carbon emissions and over time, it's not a good idea to make the country poor in order to do that. And in any case, Britain is just exporting its carbon use to other countries. So the key solution for all countries in terms of most of their policies is we need to figure out, you know, how to get more wealthy as a country, grow the economy, and then we have the ability to respond to these things.
I'm going
to
go back to my solution, which is to continue that tobacco vaping. The key solution to giving up tobacco is to stop smoking cigarettes, stop having nicotine, not to vape. The key solution to man-made climate change is to stop putting carbon dioxide into the air caused by gas, cows, and coal. Stop putting that into the atmosphere and use science to try and address.
Well, I mean, you don't need to use science, just use your memory. I mean, so when we were growing up, there were no cars in our street, maybe one or two. Mm. Everyone just walked down the road, got on a bus, got on a train. In fact, if you go back to the 1950s, you'd get on a tram. And this is the sort of revolution, supposedly, you know, represented by things like the Mini in the 1960s and 70s. Suddenly, everyone's got to have a car to get around. If we were to
But the Minis that we have now are twice the size, three times the size.
Well, they're also built by a Nazi company.
But if I can say, I mean, I am in favor of better planning. So I would like to see better planning, better buildings being built, more of them, and being built in such a way that people don't have to rely on a car to do everything.
How about short commutes? So you're working close to where you live.
Exactly.
These basic things.
No, I'm in favour of all of that. Absolutely in favour of
all
that.
If you go up to the Severn Bridge here in the evening, around about 5, 6 o'clock in the evening, you see a massive rush hour of people coming from Bristol to the cheaper houses in Newport.
I'm in favour of all that because it's actually more economically efficient. I mean, of course it is. If you don't have to drive to work, you save a lot of time.
Oh, right, okay.
You know, it's the cost of going. I mean, it's extremely efficient. So that's what we should be doing.
I think if you go back a few hundred years, everyone was doing this, weren't they? They lived in their local village. They probably never, ever left. They might go to their local market town once or twice in their lifetime.
Yeah, but
they would just stay in the village. Why is this obsession with... Obviously, we want to be able to get around, but let's do it, I think, on cheap public transport. That's the way to do it. Free, even.
Yes.
Which is what Ken Livingstone was trying to do in London when I was growing up by his fare policy, saying that, see, this is a bit of... socialism for you, Paul, to be a bit radical here, is that the people, through their rates, everyone in London was paying a little bit, not much actually, towards a public transport system that was free. Now,
you see,
if that had been allowed to carry on, and it's what Livingstone was elected to do, and he was stopped through the courts from doing it, was to literally make everybody, it was a total choice to have a car or not. So you weren't forced or coerced to have it. You knew you could get around cheaply and easily to go and see your relatives or to work on public transport.
And quicker.
But, John,
when
you talk about moving from tobacco to vapes, you're making an interesting analogy. And it's a technology analogy. But I don't think the move to net zero and the move to windmills and solar panels in the UK, actually, the analogy I use is Chairman Mao's Great Leap Forward in the late 50s, when he sort of decided, we're going to have a smelter in every village. You know, we're going to do, every village will have its own ability to make steel. And so he had this kind of rapid industrialization idea. And the whole thing ended up in a complete disaster and famine. And I think there's something of that about Ed Miliband and net zero. I mean, truly what Britain should do is it should, and this was recommended by Catherine Porter, who's an energy consultant. We had her down in Wales, and she's both a physicist and a sort of energy economist. And her solution is very interesting. She said we should, you know, go to South Korea and buy their mini nuclear reactors, which are relatively cheap. They're highly regulated because South Korea is a proper country with proper rules. Don't start imposing our own overburdens and regulation on them, which they tend to do. This is part of the cost, I think, of the reactor in Somerset that's currently taking forever and is going way, way beyond budget because the nuclear energy regulators are just Hinkley Point. They're still sticking their oar in. So, you know, let's have much more cheap nuclear energy and I think we should be drilling, we should be fracking. I don't think we should be covering the place in windmills and solar panels.
Can you answer my question, though, about Ken Livingstone and London and public transport? I mean, that was, I think it was in the 1980s. He was saying, look, let's just take a half a percent or something like that from people's rates and we can run the buses and the trains and the undergrounds in the city for free. Some cities around the world have done it. Seattle's done it. Others have.
It was a fair's fair policy, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's not a completely ridiculous idea. I mean, in many cities in Europe, they subsidise.
Well, make a socialist of you, yeah.
I can give a real-time update in that. I've reached an age where I qualify for the free pass. Not the freedom pass, not that old, but it's free. And I have to admit that my travelling around London, I have family, I'm from London, I live here too. My travelling experience has gone up since I've got the free pass because the fares are phenomenally high. If you haven't got a freebie, it costs a fortune. But with the pass, I'm able to travel a lot more, and I do, and it's remarkably freeing. And I am grateful for the tax that I've paid and the other taxpayers paid to make it possible. And everybody should be entitled. But just to, I don't know, jump into some of the stuff, Burnham, some of his policies, if you like. The idea of us paying in so that we can all take out, collectively, state control, taking back control of utilities, I'm up for that. I'm very, very much up for that because the private sector and the market, in my opinion, are not our best friends.
Well,
they're their own best friends.
I mean, the great problem that happened in Britain was that the government created a whole bunch of essentially private monopolies.
Mm.
And the example I always use is Bristol Airport. Bristol Airport was certainly owned by the Canadian Teachers Pension Fund. I think they've sold it to somebody else. And the entire airport is designed to extract as much money from you as possible when you go into it for any purpose, right? Now, to me, that's a competition regulator matter because there's no alternative Bristol airport that you can go to.
Well, this is the problem with all these privatisations.
Yeah, but
the regulation.
Yeah.
Look at what's happening with water.
But I don't think even Maggie Thatcher intended this, but, you know, Thames Water, they essentially created this financial vehicle, and they borrowed all this money, and then they paid themselves, and they have all this debt. And again, you know, there's no alternative source of water that you can go to. So the market, in fact, doesn't exist. The market didn't punish them. In those situations, you need a very tough regulator. The regulators in Britain appear to have sided with private sector financialized monopolies. And I suspect the incentive is to pay taxes on what they're making to give to local authorities or whoever's supervising them. I went to Bristol Airport about 6 months ago, and I foolishly sat in my car waiting for my son's plane in the car park, and we were chatting for about almost an hour. They charged me £60 to park for 1 hour in Bristol Airport, which, you know, other than being an airport, was farmland, basically. And this is entirely a vehicle to extract money from you. And to me, it should be, you know, it should be a competition authority issue, a competition, a regulated commission question. It's just it's just rip-off.
I mean, I think the reason why is over the years, all the people that worked for the regulator then went into the industry, and they were like a pipeline into each other.
They've been captured.
And
Braintree captured.
That's right.
Revolving doors. Yeah. So maybe they should never have been privatised in the first place.
Oh, I wouldn't have privatised any monopoly. Should not be privatized. Or if you were going to privatize it, the regulator should be, you know, armed with a gun and incentivized, well, metaphorically, and incentivized to intimidate the hell out of them.
So when Nigel Farage takes over, there's going to be a massive wave of renationalization.
I suspect the priority of the party is going to be to take a long, hard look at the regulators. But if any political party, including Reform, that gets into office and doesn't address the abuse of consumers by privatised monopolies is going to lose popularity. No question. It's going to be a black mark.
Okay, well, we've got a new guy in charge, a new kid in town, Andy Burnham, with his eyelashes and his T-shirt, black T-shirt. And so let's have a listen to his big, he had a big speech this week. So rather than, like you said, taking any questions, he decided, I'm just going to tell everyone. And there was no questions. Maybe we'll hear a little bit of a dig at Chris Mason that you were mentioning. But anyway, it's a long speech. It's around about 40 minutes or so. We've got a little bit of an extract now.
We need a complete rethink of how we support the next generation to succeed. And it has to start with the education system. The days of a school system configured entirely around the university route will be brought to an end. University is great for those who want it, but when are we going to focus on the life chances of those kids who want something different? When? The country hasn't done that for a long, long time. People have argued over many years for an education system based on parity between academic and technical, and that is what we will build, giving every young person growing up here a clear path into a reindustrialized Britain. Where young people need mental health support, it should be provided as part of in-work support. And we will answer the call from the mayors, and particularly the mayor of the North East, for devolution of employment support and changing the way we support and sustain people's employment, working much more through our community and voluntary sector at a grassroots level, working with organisations people trust to help them rather than going to places that they fear. This is the difference that the mayors can make. And in doing that, we will reduce the welfare bill in a way that is fair and lasting and helps people move forward. Another way to do that is by repairing the public housing stock. Britain has lost almost 1.5 million council homes since the 1980s, and around the same number of people are now on housing waiting lists and have been there for a very long time. As a result, the country is in a housing trap. We are forced to chase rents in the private rented sector through the benefits system. When governments try to control these costs by freezing local housing allowance, it makes families homeless and places unfunded pressures on councils when they have to pay for temporary accommodation. Britain's housing crisis is having a ruinous impact on its public finances. So, working with local areas, Number 10 North will oversee the biggest council house building programme since the post-war period. We will use public land, vacant public land, to reduce costs. Let me just take you back to when I grew up here in the 1970s, and Steve Rotherham and I have written about this in a certain book. But when we were growing up here, amongst the friends we had at school, there were two things that were the foundations of working class aspiration. A council home, a secure home that was the foundation for everything. And then good technical education. And those things have been taken away in the decades since. So no wonder so many young people struggle to make it work and then don't make it work. Don't blame them. Blame ourselves. We haven't been giving people this stability, this ability to get on in life. And it's time we did and brought back working class aspiration, the chance of somebody growing up here to be everything that they can be. And that's what we'll do. And also make this a city where no one has to leave to get on in life, or any of the other cities represented here today. That's what this new era is going to be all about. A sense of hope, of possibility, that things are achievable that you might not have thought were before. And having this focus on council homes again and building them in all parts of the country, it will represent a decisive shift to a more preventative, productive state. Adopting a national housing first philosophy, as has been pioneered so successfully in Finland. If you don't give people a good home, what chance have they got of having a good life? What chance of making the health service sustainable if people are not living in good accommodation or getting a good education for kids? Everything starts with a good home, and this country finally has to put that at the top of its priority list.
So that's Andy Burnham, the new Prime Minister-to-be, already being crowned kind of king, really, speaking. And he was concentrating, Don, on housing there. I mean, there was also talk about education. What did you make? You obviously heard the whole speech. What did you make of it?
Well, on the housing thing, I have been waiting for a Prime Minister or a potential Prime Minister, someone who could be Prime Minister, to use the term, I want to build social houses. I've heard housing, I've heard affordable housing. Boris Johnson, that translated as in London as 780,000 purchase price was affordable housing. I don't know who he hangs with, but not the people that I do. So to have social housing being built, yes, because
he actually says council housing there, doesn't he?
He does. I think at some point he also says social, or maybe it's in another one I've heard him say social. The point I'm making is that we have since Margaret Thatcher privatised the housing market, completely, totally controlled by developers, and it's just not on. And the state needs to take some control of this. I'm going to use a real life example. I stayed in a place in London. I was paying, if it was a property that was clearly ex local authority property. The rate for local authority property, let's just say, I'm just using these numbers fictionally, was £500 a month for the private person that I was paying. It was £1,500 a month, and I had to get, and I had a job, and I still had to get the local authority to help me make a payment of over £600 towards that cost. So it's just nuts to have a system that works like that. Build social housing. The other thing let's just leave that there for now. But
well, I was looking at my family in the 1930s, and they moved from, this is because they were building loads of council houses in the massive, massive estates of thousands and thousands of council houses. And they moved from a little flat on the Old Kent Road with three kids and another one expected in a little two-bedroom flat out to a brand new council house, three-bedroom council house with a garden. In the night, about 1933-34. That was an answer to something called the 1929 Wall Street crash.
Yes.
What the government did is they said, look, we can't have all these people sitting around doing nothing with no jobs and no way to feed themselves. And they created work government work schemes in order to build these massive. And if you have a look at the modern affordable housing, right, you'll find the rooms, the houses
they're
are so
terrible.
Much smaller than those 1930s council
really rubbish.
Council estates.
I've been in a few, you know, I've got friends in London and seen some of these, the tower blocks that have sprung up, and they are. I think, how could you live like that? How much did you pay? Are you kidding me? I think we're in a place, you know, we're in a better place where I believe in that people are generally good. And if good people were running this thing, yeah. i.e. it's not being run for profit.
So where do they find this lot?
Where do they find them? They're out there. Oh, I have no doubt. They're out there. They're around this table. They're out there.
Where do they find the people now running things?
The problem is it's the people that are running things, and they're slowly coming to the realization that just privatizing the education system, the health system, the housing system is not going to work. These are public things owned that should be owned by the public, and I believe the private sector should have its thing and do their things. I have no problem, no beef with the private sector at all, but just certain things like and Andy Burnham said it, the most basic thing: how can you do anything in your life if you haven't got a roof over your head?
Yeah, Paul, reform and housing, because this is a biggie, isn't it?
I think it's like anything else. Well, it's not quite like anything else, but it's like some of the things. So, for example, just because people are doing something for profit doesn't mean it's going to be horrible and too expensive. So, for example, supermarkets in Britain make a relatively small margin. I think it's somewhere between 3% and 5%, and yet, you know, we don't insist that we have state-run supermarkets because everybody might starve to death. You know, we trust the market to sort of provide us with food. There is competition in the sector. The problem with housing is that it's a market in which the state, both local government and national government, particularly local government, has huge power, huge veto. The power of NIMBYism is enormous.
You mean over planning? Whether you can build?
Yeah, you can't build. So essentially. Any government coming in to office has to be really, really, really assertive about the fact that we want to increase the supply by a lot. And that means changing whatever laws you have to change to make sure you can increase supply.
So is it public? Are you after public housing, private housing, both, or what?
I do have specific. It's a sort of a joke between me and my friends. It's how I know I'm not English, because I'm actually quite a modernist in my architecture tastes. And in England, everybody hates modernism, or at least most people seem to hate modernism, except it's actually apart from sections of the left. I've got quite socialist tastes in architecture.
Well, don't people just want a roof over their head? They don't care too much about the architecture.
Well, no, I don't just mean the architecture as in the aesthetics. I mean just, you know, the quality of the houses that are built. A lot of houses in Britain, I mean, part of the problem in Britain, and sorry, this is a slight digression, but a part of the problem in Britain with housing built in the 60s, especially tower blocks and new estates, I've always been intrigued by this because these houses were often, actually, these flats were often very, very good, quite big, very nice. People went into them initially, they were really impressed, they were lovely. Part of the problem is, and this, it was then accepted that the sort of subsequent failure of these housing estates, the subsequent problems that occurred in them, this was all the fault of the architects. You know, they were soulless, they were horrible, and there were some problems. You know, there were problems, but the mere fact that they were high rise, you know, was not actually the problem. You know, if you go to Park Avenue in New York, you know, you can live in a very high rise building in Park Avenue, New York. You know, on the 60th floor. Okay, it might cost you 60 million quid, but it's got security. That's the point. And what they didn't do is they didn't invest in curating, you know, who was allowed onto these estates, who was allowed to live on these estates. If you wanted a council house back in the early 60s, you needed a job. You couldn't just rock up with your girlfriend and say, you know, oh, you know, Doris is pregnant, give me a flat. They'd tell you to get lost. Because, you know, the definition of working class, you know, the key word was working. You had to be
there
working.
There were jobs.
Yeah.
There were jobs.
There were jobs. But my point is...
there was
my,
work.
But my point is, if there's going to be council housing, it has to be for people who need it, who are working, who are serving the state. They may be nurses.
But I mean, if you go back to the 60s and 70s, you could almost pick and choose jobs. There were factories everywhere.
Yes.
Loads and loads of work.
But it all fell apart because government started putting families into states who had social problems, didn't have jobs.
And didn't put in enough money to facilitate that. The difference between a council 12-story, 20-story council block in southeast London and a 20-story Park Avenue skyscraper is money, and loads of money is being put into.
Yeah,
I've been in buildings where they put a concierge on the ground floor.
Yeah.
Makes a remarkable difference. I've seen in places.
That's what I mean.
The cleaners come every day.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They should have invested in security, but they should not have given flats to people who were just going to cause trouble and really, you know, threaten their neighbours.
But in this city, we've got 15,000 people on the housing list. 15,000.
Right. Well, that's
where are they going to go?
That's an outcome.
Never mind the.
To answer your question,
is it going to be private, public, whatever?
To answer your question,
we need 15,000 new.
Right. So to answer your question, of where it's going to come from? I think just address the planning issue so that you incentivize people to come into the market to build houses, allow people to build houses, insist on, I think, better design for houses. A lot of housing doesn't look that nice. It's too small.
I was actually going to say, when you mentioned you were talking about it, the best houses I've ever seen, the best houses I've ever been to, have been houses that have been owned by architects. They live in the best houses. They have nice houses. They know what a house needs.
But we can't
afford those.
You're talking about council houses.
We can. To your point, we can.
It can be done.
Yeah, it can be done.
I mean, if you look at a lot of modern housing now, I mean private housing, it reminds me of a 1990s video game in which they are showing you a representation of a traditional house, and it's kind of almost pixelated. You know, it's a poor resolution. A lot of housing in Britain is very ugly, and it's just shoved in, and it meets minimum requirements. I remember saying to a developer in Ireland who was building, he was trying to build in the city of Dublin, and you couldn't go up in Dublin higher than about six stories. I mean, this was in the centre, right? And so, you know, you have commuting distances of Tokyo, right? You know, in a small European city because people can't come in. And I said, you know, the problem with you isn't that you're making too much money. The problem, in fact, is you're not making enough money. People like you need to be empowered to build, made to build better housing, but much more of it. And you know, go high if you have to go high.
I think the solution is to go high. You've got to go up, but you've got to then put the money in to be able to maintain those
things.
And for those people, there is an element of making sure that the right people are in the place. How you decide that? It's not criminals that I'm more afraid of.
Mental health.
Mental health side. And just drop them into an area or into a block and say, yeah, off you go. That's not going to work. But I'll just return quickly to the NIMBYism thing, because it was, and I'm not sure if we mentioned this last time I was here, but the one of the Soho Society, the peoples of Soho, have appealed against every single development plan that's been in their area for the last, let's say, the last 10 years. Not one plan have they approved of. And you don't move to Soho and say, well, we don't want more nightclubs. You don't move to Soho. You don't move to Heathrow and say, we want less planes.
I want to hear the birds singing.
The NIMBYism of it. So somebody does have to take control. And Starmer said he was going to, didn't. Others have said they were going to, of all parties, haven't.
Yeah.
Burnham says the same thing. We'll see who wins, the bats or the people. And it's time we started nothing against bats, but we've got to put people first. One of the interesting things this week, that I don't know if you know this little factoid, but this week, I think it's this week, was the week that HS2 was supposed to be completed originally. This week. Remember HS2? We can't even build a railway line.
Do you remember Lord Adonis?
Oh, yes.
He was the guy, wasn't he? He decided he was going to swap parties as well after the election. I mean, it's all, I just think contract fraud when I see, I mean, there was a massive amount. And I did happen to know, I mentioned this recently to somebody, I knew a guy who was a railway, he was a Swiss banker, and he'd financed railway projects around the world. And I explained to him, he said that the industry people unofficially have been telling the newspapers this week that the cost of HS2 is going to be 111 billion.
And it's going to end in old gold common.
He laughed and laughed. He said, for that.
20 minutes earlier, how much quicker is it getting you in?
For that, you could build. He said you could build a railway around the world.
Well, it goes back to what you were saying at the start of this, and we were talking about America, and I watched How the West Was Won the other day, and the building of the railroad, and the gung-ho, and some of the not-so-nice things that the builders did. But the point is, these things can be done. So it's weird, now I'm going to say this, because what seems to work best in a lot of these things is actually a public private partnership, people working together, because if you leave the private to it, then their aim is to maximize their take, maximize their income, maximize their profits. That's their aim. It's in their DNA. I have no problem with that.
I mean, I don't trust I remember having an argument once this is a slightly different subject, but it's a comment I made, which would apply to this a little bit as well. I was having an argument with a trades union official in Dublin about introducing a workplace pension in Ireland, which I was kind of trying to push. And I said to him, companies should not be allowed to provide pensions. Now, he didn't quite understand what I meant. I think he kind of meant that anybody who could, because there'd been a scandal where people had company pensions and they'd all gone bust and they didn't get their pensions. And he got quite sort of shirty with me. And I said, no, I said, what I mean is, I said, his name, Jack. I said, what I mean, Jack, is you don't trust the capitalists. I trust them even less. And so public-private partnership, for me, I tend not to trust the private sector elements of this because that needs careful policing.
And also, I don't trust, and I've worked in the public sector, I don't completely trust them. Yeah. But if they keep an eye on each other, and that, again, this could be burnerism, as it's called.
Here's a question for you, Don.
Go back to it. Yeah.
What is the royal family? Is it public sector or private sector?
Both.
Whatever it feels like.
It's public
on
sector
the day.
Because we give them money. It's private sector because they make a load on the side.
They have
money, from their own money and their own wealth.
Anyway, Prince Billy was on the telly this week.
Three years ago, just a few miles from here, we set out to answer a simple question. Can we show homelessness can be prevented? Today, we are beginning to see the answer. Yes. For too long, homelessness has been seen as a problem to manage. Homewards is showing it can be prevented. Across our six locations, we are seeing measurable signs of change. 3 years on, Homewards has helped more than 73 people into stable housing, supported more than 250 people into employment, and reached thousands before they reached crisis. These aren't just statistics. They are people who have a home, a job, and a future that looked very different only a few years ago. Because homelessness is not an individual failure. It is a systemic failure. And if systems can help create the problem, systems can help prevent it. It is clear that Homewards is changing lives. And now imagine the scale we could achieve if our approach was adopted in every corner of the country. As I visited homelessness shelters and charities from a very early age, I saw the tireless work being done on the front lines, fighting to feed, house and care for people who had reached their lowest point.
So that's Prince William. I thought when he started off, yes, we're going to do something about homelessness, he was going to talk about opening up some of their empty palaces.
And he just got more and more boring.
But he hasn't told us what this charity does. What does this charity actually do?
He's not really talking about it. I mean,
no, he's not. He didn't even say their name properly. I couldn't even catch his name.
It's been going for 3 years. I mean, I would suggest here that the Royal Public Relations people have just said, look, you need to show that you're a sort of caring, sharing person and have a apparently the impact that Prince William has been making is measurable.
This is a subject about which I
know. That's what he said. It's measurable.
I do read about quite a bit about this in American newspapers and American journals. There's an American journal called City Journal, produced by the Manhattan Institute, and they write a lot about the subject of homelessness in America. And it seems overwhelmingly to be a problem of, yes, affordability, but actually it's very often addiction. Mental health is what causes people to end up on the street, poor mental health, and that the way they experts who I've read believe it should be addressed, and it's not being addressed, is you need kind of teams of people who are, as it were, getting people on the streets to act with some agency, you know, and setting conditions, mm-hmm. right? You know, you can live in this facility, but you've got to be sober, you know, you've got to take your meds. And what's happening in places like San Francisco, what has been happening, is they just write essentially blank checks to these organizations who are private organizations, who are sort of charities. And in some cases, they're spending like $160,000 a year per homeless person. And so they're almost incentivized to increase the population of homeless people who are coming into San Francisco from other states in the U.S. But overwhelmingly, and I was in San Francisco a few years ago, and I saw it. It's a mental health issue. It's an addiction issue, largely. And it requires, you know, people to deliver programs for people and a pathway out. Mm. And it seems that it's been getting worse. It's not helped by affordability. There's no question about that.
What's interesting, actually, is that the in the more rural settings, the homelessness is less of an issue. So the homeless people gravitate towards the bigger towns and bigger cities, and I think somewhere in their psyche, they know they're more likely to get help if they stay out in the rural areas. They're just going to die alone in the woods or something, or more likely commit suicide.
Well, they can beg in
cities. Yeah, well, they can beg in cities, yeah. But also there is a possibility
of work
and help.
Also the weather.
Someone will come up to them and say something and say, look, we've got a shelter. There's got a place for you. But in the more rural settings, there is none, and there literally is. You live in the forest, and then you die, or you take yourself out of it.
See, what they did in California, and I think what they... I need to check what they did in New York, is you had very liberal... mayors, and they kind of said, well, you know, we're going to give them cash, this kind of thing. Also, remember, California has a very good climate relative, so it's warm. So if you're living on the street, most of the time in California, it's actually okay.
Well, you won't die of the cold, but you will die of the addictions, because I've seen, you know, people lying on the street, you know.
So they're addicted,
you know, out of their heads on fentanyl and other substances,
we're conflating ordinary homeless with the mental health issues and addiction.
Attorneys.
Because, you know, you're looking at the figures. You're not telling me that you've got all these 15,000 people in Bristol who have got mental health problems and addictions.
I would guess that a surprising number of them.
The
have.
National total apparently is 134,210 homeless households in the country. Mm. You asked about this charity. It's called Homewoods. Mm. And just looking at their figures, there's 2.3 million partnership with these various companies. B&Q, Multibank, Bosch Home Appliances, DFS Group, insurance company, and IKEA. And they've been helping furnish what is 42 homes in 3 years. The hope is that if this is for £2.3 million, that by the end of the five-year program, they're not doing too well. They're 3 years into it, and they've done 42. They hope that they've got a target of 250 homes.
Yeah, it doesn't seem...
And they haven't even reached 50 yet in 3 years. So that's basically the figures and what
it has to be government-led.
And it's corporate. This is royal corporate money coming together to...
It's kind of tokenistic.
If they were getting anywhere near their target, they'd be over 150 by now.
This is one area where
a third of the way into
the target.
You
won't often hear me say this. This is one area where the state has to get involved full on, right? Because this is a problem that the state has to confront. It's a problem, you know, it's a problem of social services. Sometimes it's a problem of law and order as well. Because people on the streets, you know, are more inclined to be victims of crimes, and they're more inclined to commit crimes.
So, I mean, the mental health side of things, surely a lot of this is because of things like care in the community and removing people from mental hospitals.
Yes, shutting them down, putting them out there and saying, take your meds and hoping for the best. Right. And a lot of the murders that, they look at this... Yeah. person has done is based on them taking their meds.
If you talk, do you know there was a consensus since the 1960s, since the 70s, there was a consensus on both sides of the Atlantic, on both of main parties in Britain and the US, that we should be taking people out of mental hospitals.
Yes, there was. But what it was, I actually was working in the voluntary sector in South London, alongside Springfield Mental Health Hospital.
Yeah.
Care in the community and community care are not the same thing.
No.
And they were treated as if they were.
Yeah,
care in the community meant that there was going to be, again, it comes down to resources and money out there, arms around, a wraparound service around those people that needed it. But it didn't mean completely shutting down the entire hospital, because some people do need to stay in hospital. And that community care was, care in the community is what the medics asked for. Community care is what the Tory government gave them and continued with the Blair government. Can I just say, you're absolutely bang on. We are around the margins of this, because the vast majority of people that are in temporary accommodation, they probably are working, you know, or waiting for, on waiting list. They're not on the street, they are still not in permanent accommodation, and they're the majority. All right, I have colleagues that I work with in, let's call them government jobs, that are still can't afford to live, and need government support in order to pay the bills, the rent, so they can get through the month.
While this is the cost of living crisis. I mean, I do deal with homeless people quite a lot as well, and one of the things that worries me almost more than anything else is when people become homeless, they're put into a system which is now got a lot of addicts, criminals, etc. in. So, for example, St Mungo's here in Bristol, you'll find people who, they're sent there, they're homeless, they're sent to us a one-bedroom little flat in St Mungo's, and they're finding immediately that there's hard drugs around them, they're finding they're being threatened, and this sort of thing. So if you become homeless, it's almost like there's a quite a nice little punishment in there for you.
I have a friend, stroke colleague, but he's a friend mainly, who his wife kicked him out. He's on the council list, they have the council home, and he's now in a house of multiple occupation with drug dealers and mental health patients, something like on the edge of town, and they're just dumped there, and you know, and he's only ever going to get housed when he keeps kicking up so much noise and so much stink that they think, we've got to get this guy out of there and into the place and away from us. We don't need to. This is not how the system is supposed to work. This is my point. And we should be able to offer that person alternative accommodation relatively near to his children, for which he was the main carer, and not his ex-wife. His ex-partner, because although he was also her main carer, she's decided to go another way. But the kids are still his responsibility. But no, people are, you know, this city's weird, where we've created these little zone, little dumping grounds where, well, if you're like that, then you get put there. If you're like that, you're put there. No, we can't work out where you go. Well, you go into this area where we put the people we just don't know what to do with. And it's, if you drive around, let's call it Greater Bristol, you can see it's very clearly, as you drive from area to area, it's like, oh, this is one of those areas. And it's nuts. And it's not an accident.
For me, my own point of view is, if you look at housing and homelessness, what we need is to reduce the amount of money that people are spending on their housing, and less money going to the banks and landlords in between, just so that people can take this bit of this burden off their back. I think also, and we really ought to talk about Brexit, I think, since we're 10 years on and we've got reform sitting in the room here, about whether or not we now actually have any ability to vote in people that we want to run things, because quite clearly this is the cost of living crisis, both with housing costs and particularly energy costs, transport costs, that sort of thing, and now with food costs as well, is driving people into the ground at the same time as employment opportunities seem to be. I mean, we had the lady from Bristol Bristol Glass on a few weeks ago. They've had to close because their manufacturing can't make glass anymore because of the energy prices. Mm. So we're seeing many small and medium enterprises up against the wall. Obviously, the hospitality sector have been hit really hard. Yeah. And so there's less and less opportunity for jobs. But you're being told all the time, sorry, the energy price cap is going up. Oh, sorry, your rent's going up, etc. Yeah. So something needs to be done about all this. And surely Brexit was proffered as the great solution. Now you'll be able to decide. It's not the big higher-ups, the banksters, who are going to be deciding these things. You can put us into power, and people in Westminster will sort it out for you.
Well, I think that... approach this. I think that Brexit... I mean, at the time of Brexit, I was living in Brussels, and I made the argument to friends of mine. At the time, I didn't actually support Brexit. Now, I wasn't I wasn't against it, but I just didn't think it was a good idea at the time. But the reason why I didn't wasn't because I object in principle to leaving the European Union, and it's not because I don't sympathize with people who voted to leave the European Union. The argument I used was, I said to people, if Britain has 100 urgent problems it needs to deal with right now, 1 to 100, you know, with the, 1 being the most urgent and 100 being the least urgent, the European Union has nothing to do with the first 99 of those problems. Okay? It's just not. You know. However, what Brexit was the first shot in a revolution. You know, the French Revolution actually took quite a long time. And Brexit was the first shot in a revolution, which is ongoing. And what it did do was it was an opportunity to take out a target. Again, it was another super version of this tendency from Blair to Cameron to simply outsource to an unelected body. You know, the European Commission is not elected, right? The European Commission's role in the European Union is like the House of Commons, except it's not elected. So you have it's as if the civil servants in Britain were the ones who actually proposed and made all the policy, and Parliament got to rubber stamp it. Some people who are cynics may say that's what happens anyway. But Brussels, you know, that's the official policy. So, and I spent a lot of time in Brussels over a 20-year period. I spent a lot of time in Brussels, and I've got to know quite well and how it works. And it is undemocratic. There is a democratic deficit. And so I can understand completely why people in Britain voted to leave, because they just said, well, we've had this opportunity to have a go at the way our government runs us or allows us to be run, and we're going to do it.
I think every democracy has a democratic deficit. I've not seen a democracy that actually is truly democratic.
Well, as for the economy, though, Don, why did the economy stay? Well, I've got a theory that the lockdowns weren't, in fact, to protect us all, simply because the virus presented pretty much no risk to the population who were both working and in education. You know, if you were below 50, COVID wasn't a big threat. And so I've got this theory that, and it wasn't intentional, but the lockdowns were a punishment beating for Brexit and for Trump.
No, the lockdown was because COVID was killing people, killed family members of mine and friends of mine, several, and until they came up with something, and it, thank God for science, and I'll never thank God for anything, thank God for science that the scientists came up with a quick way to address this issue before more people died.
So you know about the science.
Unless we let the bodies pile high.
Do you know what a controlled experiment is?
I know what a controlled experiment
is. Right. There was a controlled experiment in COVID policy, okay, comprising Sweden and Florida. Florida, full of old people, by the way. They decided, they didn't say do what you like, but they didn't lock down their economies, and they didn't lock down their schools. Their rates of death from COVID were no different from anywhere else.
So, I mean, surely if
Brexit... Which ends the discussion.
If Brexit meant anything, surely it meant that we could have an independent policy on this, if you so wish.
Well, we did.
We independently
decided not to have an independent policy, but we had an independent policy.
Well, at one time, the policy was possibly going to be let the bodies pile high, and another time, the policy was something else, and the policy changed as the reality bit, I think.
But I think I've let you off the hook a little bit, Paul, here. Was it a waste of time, Brexit?
No, not at all. I think what's happened since Brexit is the administrative state, the blob, as it were, has deliberately dragged its feet. You know, it's like you hire somebody to fix your house and they go around smashing windows. Look, the place is a mess. Yeah, look, the place is a mess.
You initially said that you weren't for it, and because it wasn't the issue of the 100 problems. There are 99 ahead of it.
That was my view,
and
yeah.
So by doing it, it doesn't affect the other 99. They're still in place, and that's why we are where we are. That's why reform gets to continue going. It's why the system has fallen apart, because we keep looking at the wrong thing,
but Britain's
and
economy,
saying that's the problem. It's Brexit. Yeah, no, it's brown people. It's immigrants. It's over. Let's go over. Actually, it's our. I said it. The democratic deficit exists everywhere, and there are no perfect democracies. But unless we have a system that works for the people, genuinely for the people, we're always going to have this problem. And Brexit. Doing Brexit didn't work for the people. It never was going to. It was impossible because it wasn't the problem. Just as...
But how has France done and Germany done since Brexit?
I have no idea, and I actually really don't care, because they're in the European Union and we're not, and we stand in different queues and we have to pay more. And small and medium-sized enterprises, businesses, have gone out of business because they can't trade anymore.
But the reason for... I would put it to you that the reason why most businesses in Britain that are going out of business is energy costs, inflation.
No, it really. If you're exporting stuff into Europe and you can't now without the bureaucracy, the reason is not the energy cost. It's the increased bureaucracy that's been placed on those people.
I'm not saying people that trade
internationally. Can I
just try to draw a line under this a little bit, because it's almost as if, well, we know there's no democracy in Brussels, but you can trade. And actually the economy's better and people are happier and more people have got a job. So which is most important, that people are happy and have got a job? It almost seems to me the whole thing is rather like a kind of a gangster saying to you, look, do as you're told or else things are going to get difficult. And that's what happened with Brexit. And we've also seen, haven't we, this mass... small boats all coming it over since Brexit happened, and it all started around about the time of a seamen's dispute. It was, I think, DFDS had a strike, mm-hmm. and there were all sorts of problems at the Channel ports. I can't exactly remember which year it was, and then all of a sudden these little boats started coming over. People are dying on these boats. So I'll ask you first, Don, about this, because even, you know, some people, Indians that came to this country, say, in the 1970s, they'd be saying, look, immigration is just going too far. Mm. And the migrant crisis. So anyway, so what do you make of this? I mean, we've seen, I'll be asking Paul about this in a minute, because they've had these riots over in Northern Ireland recently.
Mm. Yeah.
And so, you know, the whole Tommy Robinson phenomenon and the migrant, what you would call the migrant crisis. How do you pull it apart?
The United Kingdom, has never really addressed a lot of the issues of who they are, how they got here, where we come from, and also where we're going. At its heart, I think, and I'll say this as a black person, that I think that all of this migrant stuff, and even the Muslim stuff, and the brown skin and people of colour, it's all about really if you allowed it to be fully unleashed, they would want me to be repatriated to a place that I've never lived. You know, I've visited, I've stayed for a while, whether it's back to Jamaica or back to Barbados or back to Africa, they want us out of the country. This country, at its heart, has never dealt with who it is. And institutionally racist. Doesn't mean everybody in it's a racist, far from it, but the institutions clearly are, and it's got a long way to go to learn who it really is. So that I think that the dark, you know, that hierarchy of racism that Diane Abbott got kicked out of Labour for mentioning, daring to mention, that hierarchy of racism, to me, it's real. That's how colonialism is, how it works. They created that and sent it all over the world. And you go anywhere in the world, there is a hierarchy of racism. It's nuts. Just as a quick aside, thank God for the football, where you see black people playing for every team. You know, which shows us more about who we really are, as opposed to, or who we've become in this interconnected world. We are all interconnected, and once we can, if we can realize that and work with that, we'll make the whole planet and the whole of the country a better place. But that didn't necessarily answer your question.
No. So what's going on with the is there any way to address this this conflict, or is it maybe just that an elite trying to bring in lots of people for cheap labor and enjoying it when they see people of different colors, both fighting on the streets?
I don't think anybody really enjoys it. I don't think it's. I think
don't the rich enjoy seeing poor people fighting each other?
No, I don't think they do. No, I don't think they do. I don't think they do. It's just a tactic that's used by some people, and it's not the rich. Actually, it's more likely to be politicians rather than people with money. Yes, I know the think tanks and all of that, and the certain corporations are putting money into this stuff to ferment certain things. But no, I don't generally think that people with money are all that bothered, to be honest, because they're in a there's a different world. You know, the world of the first class traveller, all right, or the private jet traveller is completely different from second class on the train, you know, or on the coach, on the National Express, or what's it called, Flixbus, Megabus. So they're in different worlds. That's going to be what it's going to be. What's missing is using that wealth, the wealth and the power and the brain power to actually fix the problems of and the issues that are facing the others, which involves them less wealth. So yes, I'm probably thinking about a wealth tax at the back of my head, but also then bringing the sectors together to work together to create a better place for all. To me, it isn't that difficult. As I said, I'm a pragmatist, and it's about working to do the things that have the most positive impact that you're trying on the people you're trying to reach.
So, look, I'll ask you the same question I asked Paul, which is, was Brexit a waste of time?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But sometimes you've got to go backwards before you go forward. I'm very much in the camp of, you know, why are you complaining? This is what you've asked for. This is what you wanted. It was always going to be this way because, as you said, Paul, it's not the solution to the problem. I've worked across Europe. I just remember Farage saying, "Oh, the Europeans hate us." And I remember going into other countries across Europe and into EU-funded meetings, EU parliaments, where when the British came over, thank God they're here. Now things are going to get done. You know, they love the British. It's really nuts. So to have it portrayed with Farage with his little flag there going, "You hate us," and "ying-ying-ying," these are not the people that are the problem. You know, and you've created the problem, and now you're trying to fix it by moving away from them. But actually, the problems still remain. And the problems are the system that we've set up, and it's the post-Thatcherite period, if you like. And ever since then, it's been steadily downhill, and we need to get out.
So should we go back in then, as Mr. Burnham, apparently? Half of Mr. Burnham thinks.
No. And if I was in the EU, I wouldn't want us back in. Not just because of who we are, but because of the situation that the world is in with social media and the tribal politics that is being, you know, across the planet, people are being divided. So, you know, even if we said it got together long enough to say, yes, let's get back in again, 3 years later, the algorithms will be pushing the negative side again. And until we educate people, then we can't. We're going to need a couple of generations. And that goes for the racism thing that I was talking about earlier on. People just need to be educated. Sometimes you've got to see the reality, understand it, learn from it, and then work out how to move forward in a more positive way. And that will take a couple of more generations, and the generation for me is at least 20 years. So maybe in about 40 years' time, not probably in my lifetime, then we can revisit. But not yet.
Paul, will Nigel deport Don?
He would like to. Not you.
I don't think he would like to. I believe... this is a very complicated, and we've ranged over quite a lot of issues. My sort of take on this is to some extent informed by my own background. I grew up in Ireland, and it was very, at times, very nationalistic, and the sort of discourse was very nationalistic and very anti-British. For, you know, reasons we won't go into, we haven't got the time. But Ireland, oddly enough, if you read, it's Paul Johnson, who wrote a history of well, I think the world, actually. But he talked about the British conquest of Ireland. Really, the Normans came in the 12th century, and then it was properly conquered by the Elizabethans. And he describes it as it was the dress rehearsal for everything that happened to the British Empire afterwards. You know, the people who conquered Ireland were the same; they were literally the same personnel who conquered America. And it was the first country in a modern society, which I think England was by the 14th century, that sort of treated a native people not as people we're going to conquer, as in, we're now in charge, you're paying taxes to us and you're going to our churches, which was the standard European way people had wars. But it was actually the first time in Europe a power had come in and said, actually, we don't want you here at all.
You're less than.
Yeah, move off land, right? And so in Edmund Spenser's Fairy Queen, there's a section describing, he's talking about Ireland, and he describes the sort of the local inhabitants in this kind of fairyland he's talking about. And they're not the Irish. The Irish aren't even in the book. they're kind of Tolkien-esque people who's made up, right? So, I mean, and I love the Elizabethans. I studied the literature in university. But they had this rather strange view. That said, this is something which got worked through, you know, in subsequent centuries. And is not, you know, it's not a material problem at the moment. I'm very critical of Edward Said. I'm very critical of the post-colonial movement, the sort of critique of empire, because what it did do, and what I think it's brought also partly with sort of identity politics, what it did was it took people today and it said to them, you are historically victims or descended from victims of empire, and therefore today we must treat you differently, and therefore today you must... You have a separate role in our society to represent this group of people, and I've never bought into that. And now the Irish example of this is a much milder example than the sort of black version of this for people from either.
Bristol used for Irish? We had Irish slaves in Bristol before black slaves.
Yeah, the Irish were sent off to. Sent off to the Caribbean as well, but you know, just deported, but and Australia mostly, I think. But the point is, identity. You know, the achievement of English civilization ultimately was an achievement, and it was done partly through socialists and through Christians, and it was done partly through people like Edmund Burke. Ultimately, and this achievement was that we were treating people equally under the law, and we didn't really. Treat them differently. The aim was, we're not going to treat people because of their skin color. And if we do, that's a failure, and everyone knows it's a failure, morally and intellectually.
But then we had eugenics, didn't we? And this idea that, people... Well, hang on. Yes, well, Francis Galton was British. We had this idea that, you know, from Darwin, really, that black people were somehow inferior, basically.
Yeah, it was a misapplication of Darwin. And...
I mean, they actually said that we're subhuman in the American Constitution, 3/5 of a human, so we don't count.
Well, I remember. I
just want to mention, because I'm Irish, I'm of Irish descent as well. And I am a child of colonialism because I'm also of Asian descent. And I'm also of African descent. And I'm also of Caribbean descent. And I'm also of, English? Descent, I guess, because the UK is not actually a country, it's a place. So, yeah, I'm all of those. I'm my family are from Cork in Ireland. My family's from South Asia.
Yeah.
My grandfather came from Asia to the Caribbean. My father and my mother, you know, have come from the west coast of Africa. I'm all of those. It's not identity politics. When you take away your people's identity, and this happened to the slaves going to the Americas and the slaves going to the Caribbean. When you take away their identity, then people want to know who they are. What are we doing? The eternal question, why am I here? Where have I come from? What is it for me? So, yeah, we go back and try and find out who we were. The difference is that I think we... And I say we, a lot of us, not everybody, we then celebrate all of those things. They're all equally part of what makes me who I am. When there's an old joke, but when the Olympics is on, they say, "Oh, we won the 100 meters. What? We England or we Jamaica? You know, which one? Which part of me won that?" And that's, to me, that's a positive thing, because there is very, very few people on this planet, and the Germans thought they'd nailed it, that are just purely one so-called race, which doesn't actually exist. We are all one race. It's the human race. And we pick up these other little things. So we celebrate identity. We celebrate diversity. We don't then take it and use it as a weapon, but other people are taking it and using it as a weapon against us. And it's nuts, to be honest, because the reason why all the football's got better is because there's so many more black players playing in the team. That's one way of looking at it. You know what I mean? I am joking, but that is one way of looking at it.
Well, you said something, you see, which I was going to say in another way, and in a way that actually might sound even almost like I'm objecting or being provocative. But I remember being in a debate many, many years ago, and this subject of racism was in the debate. And I said in the debate, partly for effect, I said the thing about racism is not that it's the most important thing about it is not that it's wrong. The most important thing about racism is that it's not true. Now, by saying it's not true, I didn't mean it doesn't happen, but in other words, the theory that the racist has is just not true.
Agreed.
So that's correct. We are all one race. And you know, Darwin was kind of Galton and subsequent characters who came along and invented, a social Darwinism. And that really was a kind of a racist ideology. But it was just nonsense.
But it's powerful.
Yeah, the problem was, and it's not just the Farage, you know, it's not just the so-called, you know, the so-called Farageistas who get accused of being racist. But actually, you know, a lot of it also started with identitarian movements, partly growing out of national liberation movements in the early 20th century. You know, the Black Panthers weren't exactly, you know, harmonious in their attitude about white people. They had a kind of a separate and distinct attitude. We should have a separate black nation.
No, that was a Nation of Islam. The Black Panthers did breakfast clubs and welfare clubs and food clubs, and then they got more militant as time went on, as a result of the FBI and the COINTELPRO and flooding their areas with cocaine and heroin.
I do think their argument that they had a right to bear arms was a good one. I mean, that I did like that.
Well, they're people.
I did like
they're
that.
Can I just, because we're going to have to wind up soon. We're nearly there. So I'd love to get both of you's views on the current conflicts on Ukraine, Russia.
I was going to ask you a question. You said the Third World War started, is it 18 weeks ago, you said? Did it start when Russia invaded Crimea?
This is the attack on Iran.
Oh, Iran, is that when you started it from? I started from when Russia invaded Crimea.
Well, I don't.
My clock. No, we can have different clocks. Yeah. You can start it from when they invaded Ukraine.
That was totally necessary for the Russians to do that, because the Ukrainian army were massed and about to invade the Donbass. Mm. And if they hadn't have gone into the Donbass, then there would have been a bloodbath in the Donbass.
So you agree with me that it started then?
No. I think it's the seeds of it. For me, the Middle East is the main. Because this is where I think is the most, is a, you know, both of them, of course, are nuclear tension. But anyway, so what do you make of, you know, Putin, of Ukraine? Actually, what we've got, in fact, I should play this right now. I'll play it before we hear Paul. It is Rachel Reeves has been over in Ukraine this week saying, "Hello, everyone. Just to let you know, lots and lots of money will be coming your way."
I'll be leaving soon and looking for work. So, you know, if you've got some negotiations you want me to be an ambassador for or some kind of thing,
I'm probably just looking for her new job.
Yes,
actually,
basically.
As the doors rotate, which arms company is going
Who's
to give gonna, me a
he's
nice
take,
job?
He's going to take me on.
So anyway, so what do you make of that whole conflict? You obviously, pro-Ukraine, really?
I'm not pro-Ukraine specifically. I'm pro-Europe. in that sense, and that there's armed conflict on the continent of Europe between European neighbours is a very negative thing and should be stopped as soon as possible. But then I would say that about any war anyway. But this is why I equate it as World War III starting, because World War II and World War I were originally European wars that spread further, and they started in Europe. And it's all about Europe, and we need... How's it going to end? How's it going to end? The end of Putin, but what's going to come after him is probably going to be worse.
Is he really going to go?
No, the end is probably going to be lethal, but what's going to take his place is probably going to be worse. So I think it's very likely that things over there are going to get worse before they're going to get better, without it necessarily and I'm not a religious person in any way, shape or form, but you know, I would pray that it doesn't get nuclear. That would be the ultimate thing. But things are going to get worse before they get better.
Because Lavrov has been warning, he's saying, look, there's more and more attacks using British weapons on Russia itself, and we could be going to war. This is last week. It's not really been reported.
Well, they're already at war with us. They had been with their cyber war.
What they're saying is at some point the Russians are going to hit the European countries, and then
they already are. Asymmetrically, they already are trying to cut the pipelines.
Paul, come in.
There is talk about them invading Poland. I think that I said to friends of mine at the time that Russia invaded Ukraine that the Europeans have made a mental note, a decision, and it might even be a subconscious decision. And that decision wasn't that, you know, they were going to help Ukraine win or they're going to beat the Russians, but they made a decision that Russia is not going to win this war. Come on, whatever happens, they made that decision.
But they are winning.
Not lately.
So they got that wrong. Yes, they are. Yes, they are. They're advancing all the time. The Ukrainian army is pretty much collapsing, which is why they're using all these long-range weapons and drones to attack Russia proper.
But, I mean, have you been asleep for the last year?
No.
Well, I mean, the Ukrainians are doing pretty well.
Aren't advancing? No, they're not advancing.
They're not trying to advance. But you know, the other day, I mean, they've shut down the Black Fleet, the Black Sea Fleet.
They've destroyed oil, a lot of oil facilities. Yeah. They're attacking and putting a lot of pressure now on Crimea.
And that's what I think is going to get Putin killed.
They've been given long-range missiles. They're hitting Moscow. Putin needed permission to have his May Day parade from Zelensky.
The Russians are saying it's not Ukraine that's hitting Moscow, it's Britain, it's France,
no,
it's Germany.
It's definitely Ukraine. It absolutely isn't.
Well, rubbish
with the weapons. Sorry.
Let me put something to you. I mean, I'd say the Soviet Union lost the Cold War. Not only did Putin not read the memo wasn't even addressed to Putin. And I have to confess, I'm kind of old-fashioned neocon in this. I'm pro-NATO. You know, I can't say the word, but, you know, F him. Like, at the end of the day, the West will win because the West is richer. And it's as simple as
that.
But
we don't have hypersonic missiles. If Putin wanted to stick a nuclear warhead through this door of our studio here, he could.
Okay, we don't have the technology. That Russia would not exist.
We don't have the technology to do that.
Not
a nuclear weapon. A conventional warhead through that door. They could do that. There's a technological difference between the technology the Russians have and the technology NATO has.
So you think that NATO, including the US, is outgunned by Russia?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've never read that opinion anywhere.
Well, okay.
It's funny. I think we're in a place. It's strange because
we're short of smart bombs.
I think Russia is fighting a war on the ground, absolutely, but it is also, and it's being met by an asymmetrical war because with new technology guerrilla tactics, if you like. So on the ground, they may be winning and gaining physical ground, but actually I think
they've lost a million people.
You know,
he launched the war thinking it's going to be over in about 3 weeks. We're now it's lasted longer than World War II for Russia. Seriously, I mean, in all seriousness though, Tony, if you were advising Putin now, what would you tell him? Keep going.
I'm not. I mean, if I was advising him, I would. I don't know if I've got any advice. What a piece of advice I would give to anybody in this is get round a table, draw a line, and stop it. Yeah. You know, there is quite clearly there was a massive provocation in that war when the Ukrainians outlawed the Russian language in a whole area of
the southeast
of Ukraine.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, if we're told suddenly, no, you're not allowed to speak English, you can have to speak French, I don't think we'd take too kindly to it. Yeah. You know, this is an ethnic attack.
Well, I'm going to say, I'll say this because, you know, because I can. Up until recently, I've never been a fan of the Ukrainians either. They're both two sides of the same cheek, and they're fighting each other. However, Ukraine's need for survival has been to reach out to the West, which hopefully means that they will now modify. But it takes a long time for a culture to change.
That's correct.
We hoped that Russia was going to come down the same road, but we will have to. We talked about put your arm around people. At some point, the world will have to put its arm around Russia. We tried to, we failed. As you said, Putin didn't get the memo. But at some point, It may take more generations. Hopefully, we don't destroy the planet with the weapons before that. But that's the only way we're going to get forward.
Unfortunately, Paul's got to go. But we've got one final clip to listen to for Don, which is about, was Trump hypnotized to attack Iran? This is Tucker Carlson.
Not one person who I heard made a case that this would be good for the United States. There was a lot of hysteria about Iran having, you know, ICBMs and nuclear weapons. It was all a lie. Everyone knew it was a lie. But, like, I never heard anybody say, okay, let's affect regime change in Iran, and here's how America is, like, a way better place to live in 10 years. No one even tried to make the case. So I was like, this can't really happen.
Well, the person who did make the case was Benjamin Netanyahu. And he, you know, advocated for this. But he hasn't advocated just to Donald Trump for 25 years. For 30 years, he's been advocating to president after president. I mean, why Trump?
You're absolutely right. The core premise of your question is undeniable. Many presidents have faced this pressure. Only Trump caved. That's just a fact. So as I said, I don't know why.
He wasn't hypnotized. He just swallowed it.
He may have been hypnotized. That's real. People are absolutely hypnotized. I know a lot of people have been hypnotized. I have been hypnotized. I mean, of course people are hypnotized all the time.
But on an issue like this?
What?
But on an issue like this?
Of course. We're all hypnotized from time to time. Words have power. Words change reality.
But this is a president who...
We hypnotize ourselves all the time.
But you supported him. So many lives.
Well, I didn't just support him. I campaigned for him.
I mean, I was, by the way, and we'll talk about this, I was at the RNC when you spoke.
No way!
I was. And you spoke and, you know, you were convincing and compelling in your arguments.
I had no notes. I meant it.
But you know, to come out, to campaign for him, to support him in the way that you did, and then for him to campaign on a no war, no forever wars, and for it to end up like this.
No one was as shocked as I was.
Yeah.
So my first of all, I would just say, as I try to force myself to say always, I was wrong. I've been wrong about a lot of other things, including the Iraq War, so I am capable of being not just wrong, but very embarrassingly wrong. So that's just a fact. Why was I wrong? It's not like I didn't know Trump had flaws. I know Trump intimately. I know Trump really, really well. And I've always liked him. But I know what he's like. And so I was eyes wide open in some ways. But my calculation was, and it seemed obvious, that from my perspective, what the country needs is a choice. And the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are identical in their core assumptions about the economy and foreign policy, which is what matters. And I thought Trump was an option.
Are you talking to Trump at the moment?
No.
You haven't spoken to him since?
I have not. February 28th. I spoke to him the 27th. I haven't talked to him since. I don't hate him. I feel sorry for him. What he did is a catastrophe. He knew it would be. He did it anyway. So the question is why? I think it's really important to know, just as I think it's important to know who killed John Kennedy.
Was he hypnotized?
No, no. He was just the last person in his ear before an action was decided. You know, they would say he listens to the last person that spoke to him, unless that person says something absolutely against anathema to him. So he's like, yeah, no, you've got to do it, you've got to do it. Okay, yeah, let's do it. Okay, we're doing it. And he didn't tell anybody. He just did it. So, yeah, I don't think hypnotized is the word.
I rather like the question, though. Because I think it comes from a previous interview that would maybe about a week ago that Tucker Carlson, a week previously, that had done with a hypnotist who was saying that this is how you can hypnotise someone to assassinate Charlie Kirk.
Okay.
So it's in his mind. And I quite like this idea. Because, of course, we all know about, I mean, at least most of us know about MK Ultra, this whole idea of US CIA mind control. Mm-hmm. They tried all sorts of things over the decades, mostly in the 1950s and 60s. The basic idea was, look, if we give people electric shock treatment and wipe their brain out, then we can just implant any personality we want into them.
The Bourne conspiracy. The Bourne identity.
But this is the thing. Is this is a thing, and it's out there. And
oh yeah, without a doubt. And I'm sure that there are countries, nation states out there that are practicing it far deeper than we can just sit here and imagine between
us. But there's also this thing that he talks about.
For over 50 years.
He's, I mean, this guy. It's worth having a listen to a bit of that interview, maybe, because he talks about just creating this kind of bubble mindset of Trump is Hitler, Trump is Hitler, Trump. And this is repeating this thing that then someone thinks, oh, well, I can be a hero. I can shoot him.
Mm.
You know, so this is another aspect of, I suppose, how, you know, journalists and writers of all sorts have got to be aware of this. You know, you don't accuse somebody of being Hitler because that's what it could lead to. It can lead to this sort of hate mentality and an assassination. In fact, I think it was even... God, David Attenborough. There's a couple of interesting... David Aronovich. Both of them have said in the past, maybe Trump should be assassinated.
Mm.
You know, so this is the sort of thing that happens when you've got that mentality out there. But anyway, what do you make of the Iran and Israel-America conflict? What the hell is going on? I mean, I call it World War III because I can see how it's just... Israel has been wanting to attack Iran for such a long time.
Yeah.
And it could easily drag the superpowers in there.
Well, America's there. They are in there, but they're not... And one of them's active. The other one is sort of active behind the scenes, and the other superpower, China, I'm kind of saying that Russia was a superpower, that they're a nuclear power rather than a superpower. But China's, they're all involved. They're already involved. What do I make of it?
The rights and wrongs of it. Oh dear, he says.
Right, so it's a case of, just because you don't like us doesn't mean that we have the right to destroy you. Just because Iran doesn't like Israel and openly says that doesn't mean that Israel has the right to destroy Iran. They just don't. Just as Iran, because they don't like Israel, have a right to, and they've never tried to destroy them. They act in retaliation. Hezbollah don't just say, oh, you know what? Fancy firing a few rockets today. Usually something happened and why they fired a few rockets. You know, something happened to some Palestinians, most likely. And then some rockets from the Hezbollah came in. And it's very reactive. I don't know, this just briefly before we were just talking and about the influence of governments, if you like, and policies on people, and there's a deeper game that I take that word back because it's not a game, and I hate when people use that word. There's a deeper thing that's going on here, and global politics is at play, but the solution is really, really simple. Put your weapons down, talk to each other, remove the apartheid state in Israel, and most of this then starts to fade away. Iran is a different issue. That's just been, you know, they're just between the Shia and the Shiites and their issues. It's a different issue, but they're trying to defend the Palestinian people, and so did most of the other Arab countries used to do that until someone put more money on the table. It's all about the money, honey.
It seems to be, doesn't it? Anyway, look, Donald Mack, thanks ever so much for joining us again. And we'll be back after the break to look at chemtrails and also digital ID.
I'm willing, I'm willing, oh yes I am willing. street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns jammed downtown. The killing clowns, the blood money men. Washington blows. Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before, before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Verdad, those Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, a banner for the Playboy in the Cuban sun. For Castro is the color is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets won Castro dead. For Castro is the color.
The Clash, finally. One of their couple of anti-American, well, there's several, aren't there? There's I'm So Bored with the USA. And that's a sort of up-to-date version or updated version from the year 19... Oh, gosh, sorry. What is the year of that? Oh, 1980, that's right. Washington Bullets from the Sandinista album. Before that, you heard it's called Air... Femme d'Argent, that's 1997. And at the beginning, it's I'm Willing, the Caravans and Inez Andrews. And also, of course, well, I say, of course, Albertina Walker. That, I'm not sure about the year. I'd be guessing around the 1960s sometime. But anyway, welcome back to the Bristol Politics Show with no Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. But you have got me, Tony Gossing, Martin, back. Next week. So I thought we'd start this week maybe with the more investigative part of the programme to look at the King, because he's decided rather quietly this week to make it absolutely clear that although he's the head of the Church of England, he is not a Christian, and he is going to be following all sorts of other faiths. King Charles will now protect the multi-faith nation. So now Britain is not a Christian country. It is a multi-faith nation, as many people have been talking about and suspecting for many years. The new terminology will now see the monarch protect multiple faiths. This is quite an important change, of course, because it's about Britain's been a Christian country for at least nominally, but no longer is that apparently necessary, for around about 1,200 years since Alfred the Great. And so this is an enormous change, really. And it's funny, isn't it, because we've also had Keir Starmer, who's just on his way out now as the first avowedly atheist Prime Minister as well. So there's definitely a falling away from the faith. But what is the situation when Sarah Mullally, who's the new Archbishop of Canterbury, is appointed by somebody who clearly is not a Christian? So what's happening with the Church of England, not even pretending to be a Christian anymore? The King will protect the space for faith within the multi-faith nation in a new definition of his official role. Buckingham Palace has unveiled a significant revision of the King's official role with a newly released Sovereign Grant Report. It describes His Majesty as the protector of faith across Britain's diverse religious landscape. The annual financial review of the Royal Household contains fresh terminology, positioning the monarch as someone who safeguards religion throughout the nation. So I wonder, does that include Satanism? Does that include witchcraft? What does it include, this multi-faith? And of course, it could contain anything. I think the idea is really to keep it vague. It certainly seems to be a move from monotheism over to pantheism or Eastern religions. So it'll be interesting to see how that all goes. And what I'll do is on our show page, I'll put up some pictures of our new multi-faith king, as well as, well, I find it frustrating. There should be an enormous sort of national debate about this. There's been virtually nothing, which is a little bit frustrating. Also, another story this week, I think very important, and there's no point in introducing it really to Paul and Don earlier, because it's one of those things that we kind of know about the European Union. The EU court has backed criminal prosecution for sharing Russia Today videos this week. Private individuals can face criminal prosecution and prison for sharing RT content online, according to a new ruling. This is yesterday, Thursday. EU court backs criminal prosecution. The EU's top court has ruled that private individuals can face criminal prosecution, widening the EU's crackdown on Russian media. Now, this is a little bit bizarre, because this is, one would have thought, something that's left up to individual countries. But no. It's the Brussels people that are deciding this thing. The Court of Justice of the European Union is issuing the ruling in a case from Germany, where three people are being prosecuted for publishing RTDE videos on a freely accessible website. Well, I mean, Martin and I, of course, were regular contributors to RT. So I suppose you've got this bizarre situation where Martin or I could be sharing a video interview with us and then be criminally prosecuted for it. But look, this is far more sinister, isn't it? And this is the sort of thing that Ursula von der Leyen was not elected to do. In fact, she wasn't elected at all. So this is the problem with having this fascist organization right at the very heart of the European Union, which is essentially appointed by corporations. Many of these people who are European commissioners are failed politicians from their own countries. So they've created this really rather disgusting way of ruling everything based at the European Commission. Von der Leyen herself, of course, was many years a Bilderberger. I remember seeing her at the Bilderberg conference in 2016 and hearing the hotel staff talking about how she had been given pride of place at the top of the table next to Henry Kissinger at Bilderberg. So clearly someone favoured by the elite. And So she's not someone who's been elected. In fact, it'd be interesting to see what would happen if there were elections to be for president of Europe, as they like to call themselves. But that isn't going to happen. So there's a couple of stories there. That's the banning of EU. Oh, yes, sorry, there's another one, which is just as bad, really, which is all about how the European Union are deciding that from July, online creators can attend EU summits and ministerial meetings to make videos for YouTube, TikTok and Instagram. Only problem is this guidance is for member states and it includes one odd instruction. Do not pick anyone who has published views against EU values. Right, so what's that? Nobody will say. That's the useful thing about a vague rule. You can point it wherever you like and never have to justify it. Posted something awkward about migration, maybe. Wondered whether your euro was a good idea. Suggested that commission gets things wrong or should be abolished. Against EU values, possibly not, possibly they are, but depending on what they're reading, your back catalogue that morning. So they're going to go through all of your previous posts, and they're very welcome to go through mine, and they will find that I do not subscribe to the EU values one bit. So this is an interesting, I think it's fascinating to see how they are desperately trying to censor coverage of themselves. So not only by getting rid of RT, I mean, for example, this story about the EU banning RT videos is, guess where? It's on RT. It's in very, very few other places. And of course, the Western press is not reporting it at all, criminalizing the sharing of RT videos. So this is actually very sinister. This is why I actually disagree with Dawn over, look, it's not so important, this EU thing. It is, because the ability is now there quite clearly for there to be a sort of fascist, basically a fascist system where the corporations just decide who they want to be in charge and they make the laws, and the if it's a really, really bad law, then a few of our MEPs will try and scrabble to stop it. But anyway, I think we may be time to look at other things. And one of the pieces that I thought was one of the best I've heard for a long time this week is on Russia, because I focused on it last week as well, because I think there's a real possibility here that this Russia-Ukraine conflict could turn far worse very quickly. And of course, we will get cascades of media coverage saying how terrible the Russians are, but we will not be able to hear. In fact, anyone that does try and hear will probably be thrown in jail in Germany anyway and other parts of the European Union for sharing a Russian perspective on this. It's quite clear that this is the Europeans, EU, are making all the running here, and they are determined actually to start a war with Russia, which we will all be then dragged into.
We always have to regard all of these different conflicts around the world as the clash between two systems of governance. This is, I think, clear, and this is what makes the war between United States and Israel against Iran and the war between Ukraine and Russia and the internal strife in European countries, in the UK, in the United States, Canada, Australia, all parts of the same conflict. And the two systems of governance are basically the Western colonialist empire with its governing structures against everybody else. And I think that the farther this conflict goes, the more it becomes very clear that, in fact, the interconnections, as you mentioned, run very, very deep, much deeper than we knew. And so, you know, we've seen 3 days ago, Rupert Lowe publish his inquiry into the gang rapes in Great Britain. And that's a story that has almost died, even though it's been going on for decades, because as it turns out, practically the whole British governing establishment, from the police on the street to social services to National Health Service to councils to ministries, the media, all the way up to the Prime Minister's office and the royal household are all part of the conspiracy. And we can see that clearly now, because what the report brought to light is probably the greatest crime ever committed in British history against the people of Britain. And the mainstream media said nothing about it. They're ignoring it. The royal household, they have, it's been 3 days now. They said nothing about it. They are completely silent. I think that speaks more than anything that they could say by this time, because, you know, if you really are there to represent your people, to, let's say, if you had a protective attitude towards your people, you would be out there outraged, but not a sound. And at the same time, the same King Charles, only weeks ago, was addressing the joint chamber of US Congress, calling for World War III. And his government has committed to sending 150,000 drones to Ukraine without even bothering to hide much that they will be used for strikes against Russia. Of course, I shouldn't single out Great Britain, even though they are probably, if we're going to use the Lord of the Ring, a metaphor, they are the Mordor of the whole, Western, colonialist empire. But all of the rot has afflicted much of the world, but particularly West, because, okay, if we just talk about the gang rapes, which may seem like it has nothing to do with the war in Iran and the MOU, but it's all interconnected. The same problems of the UK with these gang rapes also register in places like France and Belgium and Germany and Sweden and Norway and Iceland and Ireland. And the syndrome is practically identical. You have gangs of migrants, committing rapes, at industrial scale. And you have exactly the same response from the governments to these rapes, accusing anybody who says anything of hate crime, responding more and more in more and more draconian ways to suppress this supposed hate crime, punishing victims, being extremely lenient to perpetrators, protecting them, providing them anonymity. And it goes on and on. And, you know, it's very, very strange that this is happening not in one country, not under one government, where you could say like, oh, well, okay, something went off the rails in the UK. It's the whole system of governance that is being copy pasted everywhere. And it has the same response. And basically on all the critical issues, all these governments take practically the identical positions. So when we had the pandemic, they were all complying. They were all enforcing compliance. When war with Russia and the Ukraine broke out, same response, same side, same tolerance for genocide in Gaza, West Bank, Lebanon, same exact position, same response to organized crime at home. Same response to war between United States and Iran. And now we're starting to see all this beginning to unravel a little bit. But the forces that are pushing the Western world, the Western system of governance in this direction, they are never ever going to give up. They're never going to relent. They're going to continue trying to take control of the world, of Iran, Russia, China, Venezuela, Cuba, South American countries. And it's not about Trump. It's not even about any particular government. Like it's not Keir Starmer. You know, the rape gangs has been going on since, as we found out, since the 1950s. The undying desire to destroy Russia goes back to, it probably goes back centuries. The desire to destroy the United States goes back to practically the beginnings of the American Republic. And then all these conflicts have their internal manifestations and they have their external manifestations. And I think that the raid gangs and organized crime, together with NGOs, dominance over the media, infiltration and co-opting of the government structures and so forth, those are the internal elements of this conflict. Colonialist wars, they're the external element of the struggle. But the struggle is always the same, and it's always two systems of governance. I didn't mention what the other system of governance is because it doesn't matter. It's anybody who doesn't submit, anybody who fails to obey. And the ultimate objective is to create a one world global order, or whatever we call it, rules-based global order, or a Pax Judaica or Pax Americana or whatever it be. But everybody has to submit, everybody has to comply, everybody has to obey. And whoever doesn't gets canceled, character assassinated, physical assassinated, sanctioned, ostracized, demonized, or attacked militarily. And this, I think that the logic of this conflict today has reached a level where I don't think it's going to stop until the ultimate defeat of either one side or the other. Because they really are not going to relent. And, you know, you can see the example of Iran. Iran has been in the crosshairs for decades. They keep trying. There's no point at which they say, like, okay, well, I guess, you know, that didn't work. So let's just make peace and be nice to the Iranians. And if they want to take advantage of their $35 trillion of natural resources and, you know, direct the development of their economy and their society according to the way they like, well, we should leave them to it, right? That never happens. Ronald Reagan was bombing Libya in 1987. Gaddafi survived. Gaddafi's government survived. Did they give up trying to destroy Libya? No, they didn't. Ultimately, they ended up destroying Libya. The Al-Assad dynasty in Syria survived decades of attacks in various forms, by proxy, by sabotage, assassination attempt, infiltration, until eventually they were taken out at the end of at the beginning of 2025. Same goes for Iran, same goes for Russia, same goes for any nation that won't submit to the Western colonialist empire. And then the Chinese are aware that ultimately they are on the target list as well. So the world has no choice but to take this fight all the way to the end. And so Trump himself may have had enough. In fact, he probably had enough. And I think that it'll be difficult for them to push Trump to war against Iran once more. Even though there are now there's now information in the information universe that, in fact, the reason why Trump accepted this humiliating defeat of an MOU is because they just want to delay it, like with the Minsk agreements, until the next hurrah, right? That's quite possible, but it's probably not going to be Trump. It's going to be somebody else, because the continuity of the system of governance goes, it transcends any one administration. So right now we have reasons for limited optimism, but the conflict is not going to end.
So that's Alex Craner there, if you hadn't guessed. He's one of my favourite commentators on all of this. I think he's got a really good, because ex-Yugoslavia, obviously, he's completely got his head around what NATO did to Yugoslavia in the 1990s, which was absolutely vile, disgusting, horrific, smashing up and breaking up of what was a wonderful halfway house, really. It was its own Yugoslav constitution, which wasn't like the Soviet Union at all, but it was not like it had elements of socialism, elements of capitalism. It was a brilliant example, so had to, of course, be smashed. And so he's also the author of an excellent book on the Magnitsky Act, which was the legal way that the West and in the United States to start with tried to make sure that there were going to be no proper trade and financial relations between Russia and the outside world. And this is really the opening shot, I suppose, in the attempt to isolate and try to destroy Russia, which is, of course, going to be a total and utter failure. Millions of people possibly will die in the process if these people are allowed to carry on with their deluded idea that it's Putin that's behind all the problems in Europe. Anyway, so thanks ever so much to Alex. I'll put a link to the full interview there. I think that was with Glenn Deason, up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. I'd also this week spoke to the former Syrian ambassador, Peter Ford. I really like Peter's take on a lot of stuff. And he was saying how so much of what's going on in the world today is linked to the, in fact, the Workers' Party itself has put out something about this digital ID. So the idea is, as the maniacs now in charge here in the Anglo-Zionist Empire push further and further towards a war with Russia, a suicidal, masochistic war with Russia, so this is the Tampon Charlie in Burnham and Starmer and crew. Let's see what Burnham has to say about it. He hasn't really said that much yet. That they will realise that they will have to basically lock us up in digital prisons. Otherwise, we will say, no, we don't want this war. And they're bringing this horrific situation that's taking place right now in Ukraine and has been for the last several years, where young men are being press-ganged to fight and die for a cause they don't believe in at all. So basically, it's just turned into the meat grinder and slaughtered. If any of you've seen the photographs of people being kidnapped off the streets, like the old press gangs, you know, sort of shoved into a van, trying desperately to get out. And of course, they know that once they're put into that position, that that they're either going to be shot by their own side or killed by the Russians. And so it's a death sentence, allying yourself with the Nazi Ukrainian cause. So anyway, Peter Ford had this to say about the ID, digital ID, and this idea of putting everyone through a test to see how old you are. Well, that effectively means that you're going to need a digital ID. And he also goes on to talk some about some other bits and pieces as well.
It's obviously a cynical ploy by this Labour government, desperate to grab on to some policy that it thinks will be popular. Starmer wants to leave his legacy. And so this is being rushed in without much thought, although at the back of their minds there is a sinister, long-planned agenda, which is to insinuate more internet control generally into our lives. The key point is that there will need to be an age gateway introduced into the whole of social media. So if you and I want to go in future onto YouTube, we will have to prove that we are over 16 or 17 or 18, depending on what we want to do or see. This will require either facial recognition, so you'll have to surrender, obviously, your right to privacy in that respect, or some form of digital ID. And we know that the government from Tony Blair's days have had this huge ambition to control citizens by bringing in digital ID. This is just going to be a backdoor. The government are going to say, oh, it's not ours. It's the tech companies who are insisting on it. We're just helping to facilitate it by making optional digital ID. It is absolutely sinister, and we should be on our guard against it and resist it at every turn.
Well, look, back in the days of four TV channels, our mass media used to do it a different way. They would say that that there was what they called the watershed. At 9:30 in the evening, you wouldn't get any certain types of content before that. So obviously this is something which is needed to have a separation in media between adults and young people and children.
It won't work, Tony. This is proved already by the experiment in Australia, where three quarters of kids who were previously on these platforms have now found ways to get back onto them. It doesn't work, and our government know that it doesn't work. There have been other experiments elsewhere in the world. But it's not about efficacy. It's about shoehorning in something that the government think will be popular and at the same time allow more government surveillance of and access, control over access to the internet. It won't work. What would work would be if the government did something a bit more difficult, but which would be more effective, and that is to prevail on these big tech companies to moderate their not just the content, but the methods that they use, the algorithms that are calculated to ensnare kids and to keep them doom scrolling. This is where the government should be acting. That would be much more effective. And that's what real experts say, including people like the Children's Commissioner.
You're asking for trouble with these tech companies trying to tell them what to do. They just ignore you. I mean, look at the recent suing of Sadiq Khan by Palantir. He said, I don't think we should have this contract with Palantir. And so they're now taking him into court. So they just ignore what governments say. And if governments try to push them around, then they punish them in the courts.
And no, that's just defeatism, Tony. And the cases are very different here. There is massive public support for controlling the some kind of media access by youngsters. The government, if it applied the screws to these tech companies, would find great public support and they would persevere. But they have an agenda here. They're just using excuses so that they can control us better. And they're also depriving young people of freedom. It's not a minor point that before you're 16, you are not a slave. You have rights to freedom and access to information. Okay, it may be gently guided in some ways, like movie classifications, but you have a fundamental freedom, and the government are taking that away from people, young people. It's also a very useful medium for young people. They learn a lot on TikTok. They'll tell you themselves. It's a big part of their education. This is going to be just whisked away from them with no immediate substitutes in prospect.
So should children have the right to view pornography, violent pornography? Should they have the right to view snuff movies or satanic imagery, all this sort of thing?
Everybody should have the right. That doesn't mean that they're wise to do it. And this is what parents are for. We should not substitute the state for parents, just because parents are lax in many cases and unable to give proper guidance to their kids. It doesn't mean the whole of society should suffer loss of freedom.
But the whole point is the parents can't control what their children see on their phones.
But that come back to the point that the government has to pressure the tech companies to curb their use of these algorithms and website design aimed at keeping the kids doom scrolling and introducing them to strangers. It's about web design. It shouldn't be about freedom.
Is there a case, do you think, for more government intervention in technology? Because I can remember as a young man, the post office, all of that was, the telecommunications, telephones was all run by the government back in the 1960s, 70s, and even into the 80s.
Well, that's where we're headed back, if the state has anything to do with it. I mean, this is just a beginning. This is just social media banning for youngsters is just a first short step away from expansion. I mean, this is, you don't have to be a prophet to foresee that there's going to be mission creep. And the next thing, they'll be banning somebody else. I mean, this is a government that uses every opportunity to stop people getting information that the government don't like. Just a few days ago, an American journalist, Dan Kobolik, was stopped at Liverpool Airport. His crime, he was coming in to talk to a seminar about Eastern Europe. And Dan, I've shared platforms with him, is well known for being an objective commentator on Russia, Ukraine. The government don't like that. And so he was hauled over at Liverpool Airport. I think they used counter-terrorism powers. You know, you cannot trust a government, especially a government like this one, authoritarian already. And in the wings, you have the authoritarians of the right. I mean, their historical track record is even worse than the left in terms of protecting personal freedoms. And we see already right-wing commentators welcoming this move. They're rubbing their hands in glee. They see how it can turn into a fascist state.
What can you tell us a bit more about this Liverpool Airport guy, what he was stopped for, and whether he was detained, arrested, and how long he was held, and whether was he allowed to enter the country?
He was allowed into the country. I have only the most sketchy information, and this is breaking news for me. Just minutes ago, I caught up with it. But I think what happened to him is what's happened to a number of other journalists and politicians, including George Galloway, who in a few months ago was hauled over again using counterterrorism powers and detained for several hours. You get your phone taken away. If you're lucky, you might get it back weeks later. It sounds like something similar happened to Dan Kovalik.
Yeah, so this is interesting, isn't it? These detentions are actually ordered by the head of counterterrorism at the Metropolitan Police. He's the guy that makes final decision. His name is Matt Dukes. Matt Dukes is also the chap who was involved in trying to get Palantir to spy on Metropolitan Police officers. And he is the one who's been working with this grandson of Oswald Mosley, who's now the British representative for Palantir, in suing Sadiq Khan. So all roads seem to lead to the Met, to this Assistant Commissioner Matt Dukes.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that. But I would be very surprised if these arrests were not personally authorized by the Home Secretary, or if not authorized, that she was made aware that they were happening before they happened. She, I feel fairly confident in saying, could have stepped in to prevent these detentions. Strictly speaking, they're not arrests, because no charges are actually levied. No charges are made. The people concerned aren't actually accused of anything specific. They are merely detained. But the result is the same: intimidation, harassment, in some cases, people are driven into exile.
What about the general political situation? You mentioned the Home Secretary there. Many ministers are resigning, realising that Keir Starmer's on the way out, and I suppose they could be described as leaving a sinking ship and thinking that their time is better spent trying to manoeuvre for a position in the next government. Which is going to be the same party, but no election is taking place over the replacement of Starmer, which is extraordinary, really, with any political party is going to change its leader. One would expect, at the very least, an election about who that person is. But then there's also the political situation with this coronation and the reasons. Why do you think Keir Starmer has been forced to resign?
Well, it's a culmination of many things, isn't it? On one level, it's simply the culmination of the Labour Party's failure on every front. They got off on the wrong foot, didn't they, with the winter fuel allowance, and it's just been one misstep after another. Starmer is just the scapegoat for all these missteps. And for mistakes made by other people like Ed Miliband, who's driving the deindustrialization drive very successfully, I must say, and the failures of the Treasury. Secondly, though, his personal qualities are what shall we say, somewhat lacking. He's robotic, and he makes an easy fall guy. But I suspect that we'll only have to wait 6 months before his almost certain successor, Burnham, comes to be hated even more than Starmer and despised even more than Starmer. At least Starmer, most people thought that he was a fairly decent individual. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how Burnham measures up when he's clearly a chancer and a grifter.
What about the policies you're mentioning there, the policy about deindustrialisation? Actually, Labour say they want more jobs, not less.
Well, that's a lie. That is a transparent lie. They're constantly promising more clean, green jobs. But on the contrary, we're seeing a decrease in the numbers of workers employed in industry. And the way Labour government, Miliband and his team define green jobs would stagger you. It includes people like plumbers, people working anybody working in the water industry counts as a green worker in their book. It's totally fraudulent. The reality is that entire swathes of industry are going to the wall over high energy costs driven by net zero regulation costs, general madness, particularly industries, not just oil and gas, but energy intensive industries like aluminium, cement, ceramics, petrochemicals. They're all going to the wall.
And what do you make of the Washington and Trump announcing the imminent departure of the Prime Minister Starmer 3.5 hours before Downing Street did last weekend?
Well, you don't know whether to laugh or cry, do you? I mean, you didn't have to be, again, a seer or a prophet to predict that Starmer was on the way out, and very often things that Trump says don't turn out to be true. It was a case of wishful thinking. He wanted to see the back of Starmer for various reasons. He didn't much like him. But oddly, he pulls his punches where the UK is concerned, whether it's because he has Scottish forebears or whether it's by political calculation isn't clear, but he doesn't miss Trump any opportunity to do down British politicians.
Well, he seems to be a great fan of King Charles III, who's one of the most unpopular kings here in Britain ever. Why do you think that is?
Because he's a fool, like many admirers of royalty. He's not alone in that. But while we're on the subject, can I just say how much it riles me to hear the monarchy described as a big financial asset to this country. That is a transparent lie. It's impossible for the monarchists to point to any financial benefit apart from the number of tourists who go to Windsor and Buckingham Palace. And I've seen this as an ambassador when we had royals coming at the head of trade delegations. Anybody could have headed these delegations. There was no added value from the royals being involved. I had the dubious honor of receiving Prince Andrew, for heaven's sake. I've seen this at first hand. The royals are not a financial asset to this country. They're on the debit side of the ledger.
Parasites. It's the easiest way to put it, I suppose. It all kind of depends, doesn't it? If the character of the royalty is coming across as benevolent, certainly this lot, if you start even scratching the surface, you can see that they are, number one, they're completely interfering in politics. They're taking sides in the wars. That is Camilla and Charles. I keep trying to find this article, and I'm going to put out a little appeal there. If anyone's got the ability to do this, is to look into the past, find this article. We covered it here not long after the coronation. It was in the Times of London, and the headline was "Camilla Wears the Trousers." It was a fantastic little article all about how actually Charles is a very weak man, and that Camilla, he basically just has to do what he's told by her, which is interesting in that, you wonder whether she's been sort of inserted in there as his sort of, I don't know, mind a controller or something. And this, of course, is not impossible. It's exactly what the Nazis did in Norway in the run-up to the Second World War. So that what happened was that most of the senior people in Norway had Nazi agents as their spouses and as their girlfriends, etc. And so it's very easy for the Nazis to find out where they were and nobble them and maybe even turn them. So that's the sort of thing that goes on at the highest levels, and the planning of regime change, whether it's a regime change here or anywhere else. So if you've got access to that article, I really appreciate it. If you can find that, I don't know where on earth it's gone. It's just vanished. It's like a series. I remember years ago thinking, did I ever see that? And of course I did. It's called The Changes, 1975 BBC series. And then eventually when the internet first started in the 1990s, I managed to get hold of a copy of it, and it was wonderful to actually watch it on a VHS. But anyway, so just getting back to some news stories this week. Burnham hands Cruel, ex-DWP minister, the keys to number 10. This is before we've had any proper announcements. Of course, this idea of James Purnell being the chief of staff, his version of Morgan McSweeney. And the Canary's done a very good job on, I'll put some links to this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Rachel Charlton Daly, I think her name is, this week, on this chap Purnell, friend of Israel and right-wing lobbyist. As the Canary already reported, Purnell was the chairperson of the lobby group Labour Friends of Israel. He was also, until recently, chief exec of lobby group Flint Global, which counts BP, Amazon, Jaguar Land Rover and Uber among its clients. So a little door revolving from all of those businesses straight into Downing Street. Thank you, Mr. Burnham. Flint's also previously advised Thames Water. Okay. So you're on their side. Great. So the point of this article, though, is this chap Purnell, who's taken over from Morgan McSweeney as like the chief architect of the evil empire, he was Secretary of State for the Department for Work and Pensions under Gordon Brown. During his 2 years there, he was the architect of Labour's discriminatory contributory principle on benefits, which massively took money away from those who could not work or contribute. Purnell voted repeatedly for tougher rules around benefits, championed the Welfare Reform Bill of 2009, which made benefits much harder to claim and tied welfare to work. In other words, he voted for and was involved with the introduction of employment support allowance to replace incapacity benefit. This led to the introduction of the work capability assessment. As a result, there were stricter criteria for those too sick to work. In 2011, and less money too, and 2011 Purnell told Newsnight, and they put a link up on, you can follow that if you wish, I'll put it up all up on my show page, this article, and he wanted to cut little freebies such as winter fuel allowance and free bus passes for pensioners. He argued they shouldn't be means tested. He also said these should be included only in the state pension. Cruelly, he also attempted to put interest rates up to 26.8% per annum on crisis loans, which is basically loan sharking. So anyway, this is the guy who's now, and I think the Canary had been doing an amazing job, which is perhaps why we've got a second article from them this week. The Canary has been debanked this week by Lloyds. That's rather nice. Someone on the 30th of June. The Canary's been debanked by Lloyds this week. Despite banking with them for almost a decade, they are withholding a substantial amount of our money, and we're left with barely any funds. Lloyds has not explained why it's taken this action. Despite multiple communications, the bank has not been forthcoming with any reasons. The Canary is now in a financially precarious situation. We do not know when our money that Lloyds is holding will be returned. Moreover, we do not know how it will affect our ability to get another bank account in the future. So they've given no explanation. Our situation is a damning indictment of the treatment of independent media in this country. Well, this is a pre-war thing, isn't it? They don't want someone like the Canary talking about Russia in a positive way or criticising our own maniacal, suicidal, genocidal and masochistic leaders trying to drag us into a war with Russia. Whereby you can be potentially ruined without recourse by banking giants like Lloyds. So at this moment, they go on to say, we do not have enough money to pay our staff, again, because Lloyds are holding so much. Our situation highlights just how at risk independent media is at all times. We need your support constantly, but we also need it now more than ever. If you can donate to keep the Canary afloat whilst we resolve our debanking crisis, then you can do so here. And of course, they put a little link up to, where is this? Well, it's a one-off donation to the Canary page. Now, of course, now, you know, in the past, what's been going on is people have been donating anyway to the Canary. And that money's gone into a Lloyds bank account, which has now been frozen. They haven't actually said how much is being frozen. If you remember, we had an interview a few weeks ago with James Tweedy down in Portsmouth, who's also been debanked, this time by Nationwide. And he's had £40,000 stolen, yes, effectively, frozen. His only recourse is to actually go to court to try and get it back. So this is what's going on. It's not just Nigel Farage. He was on the sort of thin end of the wedge, wasn't he? So this is going on all the time now. So I do urge you to support the Canary in this, because they are really unique in a lot of the work that they've been doing. Just looking at their most up-to-date front page, homelessness service closing in Croydon. The Croydon council have decided they're going to close their homelessness service. Another 7 Just Stop Oil supporters are acquitted, so that's good. Just a little march there. Just Stop Oil is, yeah, I mean, you know, this is a perfectly legitimate protest. I don't personally agree with it, but that's not the reason, no reason to prosecute people for doing a slow march over Waterloo Bridge, which is what they've been doing. A whole load of policing effort seems to be being spent in totally the wrong direction, seems to me. So anyway, that's just the Canary. If people don't know it, you should do, because it's a great little website. All sorts of things going on there. Anyway, let's move on. So Peter Ford, I'll put a full version of that up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. Excellent chat with him. He's always good value. But we're going to go on now to look at something slightly more out there, so to speak, which is David Icke has been making some claims about geoengineering, and particularly about chemtrails, over the last couple of weeks. And so this has prompted Jeremy Corbyn's brother, Piers Corbyn, who has also got his own campaign against net zero, and this whole business of whether carbon is responsible for use of CO2 is responsible for climate change or not, whether it's a man-made thing or not, and make some good points. In fact, we had a debate on him with him here on this program several years ago with the climate scientist from Bristol University. It was an excellent and interesting chit chat. So I probably should share that again if you'd like to hear it. On the facts, Piers did very well. But the problem is, of course, that it's not all just about facts, is it? Because he was quite rude to the lady, so she came out of it kind of better, really. Anyway, let's have a listen to what Piers has got to say now about chemtrails, which he himself is, in fact, an astrophysicist. That was his degree at Imperial College.
Different aeroplanes at different levels flying to different destinations, and they make crisscross patterns in certain areas because there's a lot of planes going to Gatwick, for example, a lot going to and from Heathrow, or Stansted Airport or City of London Airport and so forth. So they will crisscross and they'll be at different levels to avoid collisions with each other. So everything you see there is natural. Some of the pictures put forward by the ChemCon trail PSYOP are actually AI. The poster they advertised for their rally, so-called, on the 20th of June, was obviously AI, because it was a very bizarre symmetry in their so-called sky there to make the picture look better, as a standard person designing a poster would. But, you know, it was AI. Now, a very important thing to note is there is no chemicals in so-called chemtrails. This is NASA satellite measurements where they do reflective spectral analysis on everything on Earth from these satellites. And they look at so-called chemtrails and find there's nothing in there. It's only water vapor, absolutely only water vapor. Now, the chemtrail people say, oh, but Piers, look, there's more poisons. It's all poisons. Now, they can never point to a poison coming from the sky, but they say there's more poisons in the ground, heavy metals or something. Well, the fact is that the satellite's crashing into Earth all the time, and they produce 30 kilograms of aluminium oxide daily. And there's a lot of barium compounds in there from various experiments done by the USA in near space, where they've been putting barium salts up there or whatever to increase reflectivity. These things come back to Earth and they're measured in the ground. But because you find them in the ground, it doesn't mean that the airplane that flew over dropped them at all. It's just complete disconnection from reality.
Hang on, why would people say these things?
Well, why do they put forward such a nonsense conspiracy theory? Well, I don't know. But you see, within the movement, there are people that will believe anything that isn't true because we've been lied to about vaccines, for example. Therefore, everything they say is them, meaning the powers that be, is untrue. So a lot of these people are also flat earthers, which, of course, is another nonsense. And interestingly, they group around David Icke, or, well, there's a lot of people, isn't just him, who say these things. They never ask anybody involved in air traffic control or air safety or physics or meteorology, whereas all that I say is informed by all of those four groups of people. So what is their aim? Well, their aim is just to get followers and hits, I think. But the overall aim, which could be a reason why they get an amount of publicity, is that what happens is that we, i.e. the freedom movement, if you like, gets to look completely stupid because we're talking about things which are completely nonsensical and easily disproved, we're portrayed as part of the freedom movement saying that. So therefore, when we oppose vaxxers, we're anti-vaxxers believe in a flat earth or anti-vaxxers believe in chemtrails. Well, I am definitely an anti-vaxxer, but I don't believe in either a flat earth or a chemtrail. So I think that's the reason why certain publicity may come forward. Not to say that people doing it are doing it that for that purpose. They're just doing it to get internet hits from people who like to follow things which are nonsense.
Well, I know, but I think there's a couple of things to say here. First of all, yes, contrails is condensation trails, it's short for, yes, which is what US pilots use to describe them. Yeah, British pilots tend to use the term, and European pilots are just vapor trails.
Yes.
You can, if you want, if you can be bothered, you can go online and see plenty of pictures of dogfights going on over London during World War II, with aircraft, piston-engined aircraft, and later jet aircraft, mostly piston-engined, leaving these vapor trails. It's simply combustion in any engine will leave a deposit of tiny water droplets, and those in the right kind of atmospherics will crystallize and oil form a cloud.
Exactly.
And so that just slowly will disperse, or else it actually can start to seed other clouds, so other water droplets collect around those if the atmospherics are right.
Correct. That's absolutely right, Tony. And also the wingtips of aeroplanes under certain circumstances, especially when the air is very close to saturated or, in fact, supersaturated, will also form vapor trails. So it isn't only engines, although mostly it is engines, especially jet engines. But as you say, ordinary engines do it too.
Yeah, that's just because of the compressed airstream on the wingtips. Yeah. But look, David Icke says, after we see the way weather can be manipulated technologically by heating the atmosphere and also steering the jet stream.
Look, this is nonsense. It's a word salad of meaningless statements. First of all, manipulated technologically. He doesn't say by what technology. And he talks about heating the atmosphere. Well, in what way, by what means? And manipulating the jet stream. Well, this is nonsense. Because, you see, you understand every weather system we have is a world system. When you see it raining here, there's a big, low-pressure system or high-pressure system somewhere causing circulation, which gives you the weather you've got. But all of that is controlled or goes around or by the jet stream. The jet stream is a world system. It goes right around the world and joins on itself. So if you want to change weather in any significant way anywhere, you have to change the whole worldwide system. Now, that whole worldwide system is actually controlled by forces from outside, namely the particles reaching Earth from the sun. And the most important thing is the what happens at the magnetosphere, the solar wind of particles going at a million miles an hour impinges on the magnetosphere, has magnetic connections with Earth and these weather systems indirectly, or possibly directly in some instances, which give us what we have. So you can't change the jet stream without changing this input from the sun. And of course, this is completely beyond possibilities. They then talk about things like HARP, right? Well, HARP is a radiation thing, which is experimental to send things up to the ionosphere and back again. But they talk about that as causing or steering hurricanes. Well, this is just, again, complete nonsense, because the power of HARP is 4 megawatts. It would take HARP, one HARP machine, 3,000 years to produce the energy in one typical hurricane. 3,000 years. Or 1,000 HARPs would take 3 years. Well, look, to do these things, you've got to do this in hours. So they're talking complete nonsense. Problem is, the people saying these things don't have any understanding of numbers or actually physics, because if they did, they wouldn't make such claims. And the heating of the ionosphere, that can be done, but of course any heating of the ionosphere is very trivial compared with inputs from the sun. And the ionosphere is above the stratosphere. So heating the ionosphere has, if you want to heat below the stratosphere, where the atmosphere where we have weather is, it has to get through the stratosphere. Well, that is impossible, because the energies involved in the stratosphere are huge. I mean, that's 10 to the 13 watts absorbed of most of the ultraviolet from the sun is absorbed there. So you've got to overcome that to get through it, which again is a nonsense. It is all just word salad to get followers.
Now, Elon Musk is talking about going to Mars. Ali McForever has pointed out that actually it's impossible. What do you think?
I agree with her. It is impossible because of the radiation involved in going through the Van Allen belts, that is, ionosphere, etc. Because you would get, and beyond that, because once you're also outside Earth, you're also exposed to very serious radiation, X-rays, ultraviolet, and so forth. And you can't get a spacecraft that can shield you from this, because these high-energy electromagnetism, such as X-rays or whatever, go through the metal hulls of spacecraft. So it's not a possibility. Will it ever be possible to go there? Well, I don't know. But for what reason? And, of course, if aliens are visited, they would have these sort of problems anyway. So I suspect if there are any aliens around, they'll be just machines, you know, sent to look at things and send back messages.
Well, hang on, because $1 trillion apparently is going into this, and there are millions of investors around the world who are pumping money into something you say is totally impossible. That surely... There's got to be some checks and balances. Journalists and investors are going to be looking before they pump money into something which is never going to work.
Well, I agree with you, and it's something worth investigating. But you see, most politicians are stupid. And if there's a craze for something generated by the media, they will put money into it. Like, there is a general belief in man-made climate change. And so when a charlatan comes forward and says, okay, we'll work on dimming the sun, they get paid millions. Like in the British Library, there's a group called the ARIA, the Advanced Research Invention Agency. Well, they're researching into dimming the sun, but it's impossible to produce enough of anything to dim the sun. Because if you want to dim the sun, you're going to have to put dust up there or something up there. Dust is the only way, really. Now, the amount of dust you would need to cool the Earth by as much as happened for when Krakatoa exploded, it would be the same amount of dust in the atmosphere as from Krakatoa, which maybe cooled the Earth by 1 degree. Okay? Well, that amount of dust would require all the aeroplanes in the world filled with a plane load of dust every day, flying around for 3 years to drop that dust. Now, that isn't an attainable thing. So when they're talking about dimming the sun, it will never happen. But government will put money into it. Now, the people doing the research will know it's impossible, and they could just write a little report saying it's impossible, or I could write it for them and just give the figures I've just given. It would take 10 minutes, or let's say an hour. I'd accept an hour's salary for that. But why does the government carry on with this nonsense then? It's because it's a propaganda which makes people believe there's something dangerous happening, i.e. climate change. That's why the government's researching into it. That's why we've got to obey, comply, be controlled, and pay extra taxes. Now, the extra taxes gained from the climate con, of course, are much bigger than they're handing out to these charlatans. So, you know, the thing makes sense from the point of
well,
view
it,
of
it does look possible that that Ed Miliband may even become Chancellor under Andy Burnham. I mean, he's notorious for building wind farms and also taxing all sorts of... deindustrialisation, many people blame him for.
That's what it is. It's deindustrialisation. Look, Ed Miliband is numerically restrained, I think, and I don't think you should have someone who's numerically strained in charge of money for the country. But anyway, there we are. What would he do as Chancellor? Well, probably want to spend more and more on the climate con, because man-made climate change does not exist, because carbon dioxide levels follow changes in temperature, not the other way around. The greenhouse theory is fake physics, just as geoengineering is fake physics. Well, you have fake physics, or virology is fake physics. They're used to, or fake science, they're used to justify spending gains by charlatans, for example. What would Ed Miliband do? I don't know. He would spend more on it, on this madness. But interestingly, Tony Blair has said we should give up on net zero because he wants to spend loads more money on data centres, or surveillance centres, as I would call them, which require huge amounts of power and water and a lot of money.
So that's Piers Corbyn there. Full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I did actually ask him after that. I said, look, you know, you're talking about the climate con. What does that mean? Because the climate clearly is changing. And he had to sort of backtrack a little bit because it sort of trips off the tongue, climate con, but it doesn't actually say what is meant, which is the attempt to link all this to, first of all, prove that it's, and say it's definitely a man-made thing, which is another question entirely, and then to say things like, well, the science is settled, which, of course, it isn't. There's always a battle over, and most honest scientists, all honest scientists, including my physics teacher, Martin Black, would make it clear to us and kept repeating that actually... None of what science says is a fact. It's all to be tested, everything. And this is what the BBC and others are saying, is that the science is settled. In other words, that it's a fact, which it quite clearly is not. Anyway, that's Piers Corbyn. Like I say, up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, talking about chemtrails and the SpaceX trip to Mars, as well as dimming the sun. He's a bit of a polymath, but I think once you get to understand the way the atmosphere works, then it's a lot easier to understand what's going on. And the fact of the matter is, you look up and you see nothing apart from maybe some clouds. And of course, it's impossible to really test and understand without some deeper scientific knowledge what's really going on up there. So I'd also like to move on to talk. We was talking about data centres a little bit there, but there's been a bit of a rush of activity this week in Devon over a massive data centre that is being planned for the Biddeford area. And so I think it's probably as well to, you know, there's it's just basically people are just being told this is happening. And so there's very little recourse at the moment, anyway, in terms of saying no to it through the local authorities. So the local people around the Bideford area have been trying to get mobilised in order to lobby their local authorities, Devon Council, as well as, I suppose, local town council in Bideford or wherever exactly it is, even a local parish council, to stop this data centre. And one of their spokespeople who's been articulating most of this is Nicola Crewe.
If you live in Bideford or Torrington or Barnstaple or anywhere in North Devon, this is going to be for you. I found out yesterday that they are looking to build a data centre and they're having a meeting about it tomorrow, which doesn't seem like there was much public awareness on it, because I am on social media a lot at the moment, as you probably have seen, campaigning around yellow cameras, and I hadn't seen anything about it. Now, there are also some other public consultation days, but I think if you are living in Torrington, if you are living in Bideford or Torstock, this is massively going to affect you. There's different reports about how large it's going to be. The thing that I saw with it, that it's going to be about 90 acres. Somebody said to me that it was going to be a lot bigger than that, but I'm not sure. That hasn't been verified yet. If you're living in Torrington, there is a meeting tonight at 6 p.m. In Torrington Town Hall, but check on the local groups. Make sure that you're going and getting ideas on what is the size of this, what is the potential environmental impacts, i.e. how far can you see light? So like 91 acres, which is what I was working out on last night, but I read somewhere, that you're going to be able to see light if it's unshielded for 30 miles. The noise of these things as well, the energy consumption of these things. And we just need to really be starting to look at what is happening. So we've got a massive increase in AI. We have predictions that 95% of jobs by 2030 will be able to be done by AI. And you may think that's not possible, but I'm a business owner, so I go to lots of conferences about AI. I'm talking to lots of business owners. I have seen businesses at these places where I'm going, they've got much bigger businesses than I have. They have massively reduce their team. I have not done that. I will always intend to increase. You know, we are a company that will always create community. But what I'm saying is that they are replacing whole marketing departments. They are replacing whole accounting departments with AI agents. And we can say, oh, no, to the business owners, or we can actually look at what is happening. And governments are going to move towards doing things that are automated. They're going to go towards people who, you know, won't be sick for work or won't not turn up for work or for whatever reason. And so when you're looking at policing specifically, you've got to see, why are these data centers being produced? This one is slightly different because it's to do with energy, but it's still a data center and it's massive. And why, with that kind of infrastructure, if you didn't want to have police officers, for example, you could have mass surveillance that just takes money out of people's bank account in a similar way that they do in China. You've got massive facial recognition, digital ID. We've just had another breach in India of like 850 million data was stolen from a hacker from the digital ID system. So you may be thinking, oh, this doesn't apply to me. It does. If you are living in that area, it's going to have a massive environmental impact. People in the US have talked about their local energy rates going up, the water consumption. You know, if we are building this kind of infrastructure, we need to do this with our eyes open. And you also need to be asking the question, if we are developing these and China is the next leading power, so if you read Ray Dalio, The New World Order, which talks about the rise and fall of empires, so it talks about the Netherlands, and then it talks about the Americas at the moment, and then how the China is the emerging power. So if we look at what is happening in China and the infrastructure that they have built and the restrictions that they have there, we need to be looking and going, are we inviting that into the UK? Are we allowing this infrastructure to be in place? We need to look at links as well with certain countries and surveillance and history of surveillance. We need to look at NHS, military and military, NHS and police contracts being merged and handled by an Israeli company, Palantir. You may be familiar with this. And you may be thinking, gosh, Nicole, you are talking about all these things that I'm not aware of, and it sounds like conspiracy theory. And I understand that point of view. I really do understand that point of view, because it seems very futuristic. But I think if you are interested in learning a little bit more about what is going on, I'm happy to share some people that I'm following. You need to make sure you verify, because of course, you know, there can be misinformation, and also there can be information that's shared that
maybe it was from a website that wasn't correct, or someone might have put it into AI and it's given them the wrong answer, because AI does give you the wrong answers, so be careful of that. I think we need to start really holding people accountable and finding out what is going in the local area and saying as a community, is this something that we want? Do we want cameras that have capability of mass surveillance? I have no objection about speed cameras, by the way, guys. People are like, oh, no, you hate speed cameras. I want the roads to be safer just like you do. I just do not agree with this infrastructure that's been put into place at the moment.
So that's Nicola Crewe there. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page. She's been prolific up on Facebook, although I noticed that some of the groups that she's on, suddenly she posts something and then and loads of other people post stuff which is sort of, you know, the idea is to sort of bury her stuff. But anyway, I think she's doing a great job down there, just raising people's awareness over the purpose of these data centers are. And of course, this whole thing is what they call accelerationism, folks. The idea is things are changing so fast, your brain has not got a chance to understand it before it's just imposed on you. And also, there will be all sorts of fake reasons why they're saying, well, we've got to have these data centres. Things like the effect on the water table as well, really important. I mean, where is somebody, I'm trying to remember who it was, somebody, I think it was Gareth Wynne-Jones, the Welsh farmer, today or yesterday put up a thing saying, where are Extinction Rebellion when it comes to data centres? Why aren't they complaining about them? And do we really want these things? Well, we're not really being asked. That seems to be the main takeaway from what Nicola's saying there. So I'll put a link up to the full version of that from Nicola Crewe on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Then there was this also happened this week.
Just wanted to take a moment to mark the end of an era. For almost a century, the long wave transmitters have carried the BBC across the airwaves, from the iconic Droitwich transmitting station in Worcestershire to Westerglen and Burghead in Scotland. Although the long wave signal is fading into history this morning, the memories and the connection it created will endure forever. We shall miss your warmth and crackle. Well, that's it from me, Al Ryan, and all of us here at Broadcasting House. If you have been, thanks for listening. Have a safe, quiet and peaceful night. Good night.
Well, it's like a little nightmare announcement there, isn't it? To make sure you have a safe and peaceful night. Iconic. Don't use that word. It's hackneyed. The broadcasters, we always used to be told things like this, but they obviously don't listen anymore. The main point about the demise of long wave is not just a nostalgia thing. It's that there are many parts of this country that the FM transmitters don't reach to. So maybe they have no mobile data, so nothing else will reach there. Long wave goes everywhere. If you're right in the middle of the Scottish Highlands or in the Welsh Mountains, long wave gets in there, no trouble at all. But they're cutting it off. And so what they're doing, of course, is they're cutting off our ability to hear what's going on. Now, there is a real purpose for BBC Home Service, as it used to be, long wave transmissions, and that is to let the public know if there's anything. Let's go back to what Alex Craner was saying earlier on about, are our leaders actually looking out for our interests? No, clearly they're not, because it's in our interest to be able to hear if there's some sort of national emergency or something that we need to know about. The BBC should be there to tell it to us, but they can't and they won't and they don't care. And so that's why they're switching off Droitwich long wave transmitters, is because this is just really, to me, it's just another nail in the coffin of a society that actually gives any kind of proper regard to its individuals. It's very much in line with the particularly Israeli attitude to citizens there, very similar, maybe the part of this Pax Judaica. Anyway, finally, tonight, let's have a listen to the thing about the old gods. The old gods apparently are returning. This is a bit of an old clip, but it's a good one. From the old gods are returning for Armageddon, apparently.
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with good works, but the problem is the Masonic Lodge claims in its very own writings to be a religion, that every Mason is a minister of this religion. And when you get involved in the Masonic Lodge, every Mason who is watching this program knows that in the very first initiation, in order to join what is called the Blue Lodge, every Mason will go through an initiation where he is brought before an altar, and he will bow at that altar, and behind that altar stands a man he calls the worshipful master of the lodge. And as he's bowing at this altar, he says, "I'm lost in darkness, and I need the light of Freemasonry." And then every Mason is required to take a blood oath of allegiance, where he is sworn to secrecy, and every Mason will put his thumb to his throat and will swear a blood oath not to reveal the secrets of Masonry, or he'll have his throat cut from ear to ear. And then how could any Christian, and this is what disturbs me so deeply, is that we have Christian men who join the lodge, they bow at an altar before a man they call the worshipful master. You know, Jesus said, you cannot serve two masters. And every man out there has to decide, are you going to follow the worshipful master of the lodge or follow the only worshipful master, Jesus Christ? You cannot serve two masters. And then to take a pagan blood oath, which James chapter 5 says is an abomination to God, to take a blood oath to have your throat cut from ear to ear, your bowels ripped open.
That's just the first of many oaths as you go along in your degrees in Masonry, right?
And after you go through the first three degrees of what is called the Blue Lodge, Masons are then allowed to go into either the Scottish Rite or the York Rite, 32nd degrees in the Scottish Rite or 13 in the York Rite. And there they go through a progression of rituals and degree work where they give worship and honor to Egyptian gods, Persian gods, Greek gods, Babylonian gods. And at its very heart, and you can read the authorities of Freemasonry, read Albert Mackey, Encyclopedia of Freemasonry, History of Freemasonry, read Albert Pike, his Morals and Dogma, the authority, so authoritative, he's the only man buried in the Masonic Lodge in Washington, D.C. And they will tell you that Masonry is a religion, and they claim to be the revival of the ancient mystery religions of Babylon and Persia and Egypt. And what these Babylonian cults were fertility cults,
right,
where they worship the male organ. And this is why, for example, when a Mason goes into the lodge, every Mason receives this white lambskin apron, and they will wear this as a covering. In Freemasonry, they say that all religions are the same. It doesn't matter which religion you are. And they say Jesus, Buddha, Confucius, Muhammad, the name means little.
What did Jesus say? I am the way. Absolutely. I am the truth. I am the life. There's no other way to the Father but by me. Peter said there's no other name under heaven by which you can be saved. How can you profess to be a Christian and turn around and buy that?
Where I live, I had one of the leaders of the Masonic Lodge in our town give me a call. In fact, he was the chaplain of the shrine. And he said, how dare you say that I'm not a Christian? He said, I'm an elder in my church. I teach Sunday school in my church. And I stopped him. I said, sir, I said, if you were to die and stand before God today, and he should ask you, why should I let you into my heaven? I said, what would you say to him? And there was silence on the phone for about 10 seconds. And finally he said to me, he said, well, I guess I would have to tell God I was a good Mason. Because you see, Freemasonry claims to be a religion of morality, that through their own good works and through their own good efforts, they say, look at the children's hospitals, look at the burn units, look at the things we support. You know, there's nothing wrong with good works, but friends, good works are not going to save you.
As we draw closer to the end of this entire system, to the very last page of the Bible itself, as we get closer to this tribulation, we're beginning to see a change in humanity. There really is a dividing that's taking place right now. People are being separated to one of two camps, sheep or a goat, wheat or a tare. And if you pay attention out in the streets, you'll notice more and more people are manifesting different kinds of energy.
Don't spit on you!
Don't spit on! I hate you!
So that's actually Bill Schoenblum there, but it's from taken from a video, The Old Gods Are Returning for Armageddon 2022, which is, I think, an excellent, it looks at all sorts of the, you know, the sort of Molochs and the Baals and all these sort of, and how they can be seen in the modern world, although they're not talked about, of course, by the news media and any other mainstream press. We have an ode this week from Patrizia. It's called Bon Viveur. Old sea dogs think they rule the waves, splitting tacks on good old days, suited, booted on red leather seats, on war, defence and budgets bleat, all living in their bygone days, while rural Britannia try to save. Alan Wills, John West, not fish, loves to serve a fear-up dish. His hate for Russia, plain to see, the days of old, long gone, when we, on crest of wave, be taken in and send our men to die on whim. Rape, a word now weaponized to drum up hatred served with lies. Mystic Meg they've all become when touting for the war, bang drum. Money, money for defence. Here lobby lads on war make sense. Backhanders, bonds, vast riches bring. On Russia's evil, hear them sing. Well, thanks very much for that, Patrizia, as usual. Thank you. And time to wind up now. So I will be putting up Martin will be back next week, God willing. And I'll be putting up all sorts of interviews, particularly the ones with Piers Corbyn and a full version of that, and with Peter Ford, up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. You'd be amazed how easy it is if you've got the app to listen in the car. Stick a Bluetooth on your phone and it all works amazingly. Any questions about the app, you can just message me or else to the developer. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to our guests, that is to say specifically Donald Mack and Paul MacDonald, who's the Wells and Mendip Reform Chair. Also thanks to Piers Corbyn and Peter Ford. Thanks to all of those, and of course sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download this show as an MP3 from 11 p.m. to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. The main page for all of this is at thisweekoneword.org.uk, where you can donate or even set up a small monthly sub. Thanks very much if you already do that. So this show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the Talk Radio stream, except on 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when you can hear the Richie Allen Show live. And we're streaming live now from Bristol on the Talk Radio stream, djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Bristol Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable St. Paul's Carnival weekend. Of course, there is no, apparently, in Bristol St. Paul's Carnival, but of course there is, because the Afro-Caribbean community always makes sure that there is a St. Paul's Carnival, even though officially there isn't. Do please join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5 p.m. British summer time. God bless. If we can be bothered, the Bible explains everything today and that yet to come. And don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters, that's the goatee side, get you down.
the sun and cast his way. All I need is a place to find, and there I'll celebrate. Thank you.
take us away from civilization. Brought us to slave in these deep plantations, fussing and fighting among ourselves. Nothing to achieve this way, it's worse than hell. I say, get up and fight for your rights, my brothers. Get up and fight for your rights, my sisters. Get up and fight for your rights, my brothers. Get up and fight for your rights.
Just got here through Paris from the sunny southern shore. I'd the Monte Carlo wind just to raise me winter rent. Dame Fortune smiled upon me as she never smiled before, and I've now just lot of money, I'm a gent. Yes, I've now just lot of rhino, I'm a gent. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girls declare, he must be a millionaire. You can hear them sigh and wish that I can see them wink to the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girls declare, he must be a millionaire. Hear them sigh and wish to die and see them with the other eye of the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. I stay indoors till after lunch and then me daily walk to the great triumphal arch, each one grand triumphal march. Observe each observer with the keenness of a hawk, I'm a mass of money, linen, silk and starch. I'm a mass of money, linen, silk and starch. Oh, 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 oh. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girls declare, he must be a millionaire. You can hear them sigh and wish that I would see them wink to the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girls declare, he must be a millionaire. I patronized the tables at the Monte Carlo Hill till they hadn't got a sou for a Christian or a Jew. I then flew off to Paris for the charms of Mademoiselle, who's the darling of my heart, what can I do? When with 20 tongues she swear that she grew. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, could hear the girls declare, must be a millionaire. Could hear them sigh and wish that I would see them wink to the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air,